Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. And I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband.
Alright, alright, alright. How you doing, everybody? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and here until 4 a.m., as I am every weekday morning, starting on Sunday night into Monday morning. It is going to be a Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we are going to have Eric and Steve on, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress, to talk about the movies of the decade, best films of the decade. We did the best films of the year last week, and now we're going to do the best films of the decade since we are finishing up. We just finished up a decade, so we got that stuff coming up. We're going to talk about some game shows and game show fails a little bit later on. Neil Peart passed away over the weekend, and that one hit me pretty hard. Neil Peart, drummer for the rock band Rush, who I think was one of the greatest drummers that ever lived. Also a great songwriter, and he was 67. He passed away, and that's a big loss to the world of rock. One of the greatest drummers that ever lived, and so we'll talk a little bit about Neil Peart and some of the essential Neil Peart tracks that you have to listen to. And we got some predictions for 2020 as well, and some weird things that we were punished for real. So other great stuff to talk about here on WGN. As always, the phone lines are open at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You could also follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on Facebook, too, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Great way to stay connected. You can also download our podcast, subscribe to our podcast. We have a lot of people who listen to our podcast, and we appreciate that. You can go to iTunes or any place you can get the podcast. It's free. Subscribe, and they will automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So that's what's coming up on the show. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. Let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm doing well, Nick. How are you?
All right. How was your weekend?
It was very good. Had a great time.
Yeah. You hung out with Michael Shannon.
I don't know if I would say hung out, but I was in a room with him, and he was kind enough to talk to me for a sec.
Yeah.
And got a nice picture with him.
Yes, he did.
He's a very nice guy. He seems to not be really into the fame thing.
No.
From what I can tell, which
no.
I'm totally cool with, because he was very kind with his time. Like, he didn't not talk to anybody who wanted to talk to him.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the fame thing never really has grabbed Michael. I can tell you that for sure. Well, listen, the guy watched the Academy Awards from the Old Town Ale House, you know, when the movie that he was in was winning Best Picture. So that's the kind of guy he is.
That's where his priorities are.
And, you know, goes back to work with Red Orchid Theater, which is a theater company, local theater company, where he's not making any money. And they, you know, the house seats about 60. And yet he comes back. You know, this is a guy who has been nominated for an Academy Award. He's in big-time movies. But he keeps coming back to Chicago, staying here, hanging out, doing interesting things like, you know, spinning discs and singing in cover bands and stuff. You know, this is an Academy Award guy. It's an Academy Award nominee. But he's a good guy. And he's always going to remain local. There's just no, there's no question about it. So, but yeah, so that was fun, huh?
Yeah, it was good. And he had a really good taste in music, you know?
Yeah.
He was spinning some good stuff. Little Bowie here and there. It was interesting at one point. The whole, all of G-Man's got really, really keyed up because he played, Tom Sawyer. So
yeah,
that was really nice. And it was really interesting to see the diverse group of people turning to each other and they're singing like the lyrics to Tom Sawyer.
Yeah.
People who don't even look like they would be super into Rush. I'm not saying that you have to have long hair and wear, you know, jeans and band t-shirts to like Rush. Anybody can like Rush, yeah. But it was a really special moment. I literally looked around the bar and so many different people were just looking at each other and singing Tom Sawyer.
You know, Neil Peart's death was a big one for me over the weekend. I've been a Rush fan. My whole life I've listened to Rush. I've seen him in concert and some of my favorite, you know, and I, Neil Peart, as a person who plays drums, Neil Peart is just, you know, he was incomparable. I mean, just watch that guy play drums and it's just, you know, it's astonishing. I posted this video of a kid, 7 years old, playing Tom Sawyer on the drums, note for, like, you know, perfectly. And just this picture of just this joy on this kid's face, 7 years old. It made me happy. Like, I watched that video a bunch of times over the weekend after I had heard that Neil Peart had passed away. But I think in the world of rock drummers, there were few, if any, that were as good as he was. And not only that, I mean, he wrote a ton of Rush's songs, you know, like he was a great songwriter on top of just being, you know, an unbelievable drummer. So yeah. I love did you see the tribute that Jason Segel and Paul Rudd did?
Yeah. it was very nice. It was very nice.
Yeah. I mean, I Love You Man has got, you know, like a ton of references to Rush obviously in it. And have you seen the video of them like backstage at a Rush concert?
Yeah, because they would play that before Rush shows. They had two that they would kind of cycle through, and sometimes they would play after as well. So they would have one where it's South Park, and it's all the kids from South Park trying to cover Tom Sawyer, and it would lead directly into them playing Tom Sawyer. But the one where they go backstage with Jason Segel and Paul Rudd is really funny.
It's hilarious. Hey, is that my sandwich?
Yeah.
When they're eating, he's eating Neil Peart's sandwich. So, I mean, obviously, you know, the tributes continue. You know, if you're a rock fan of any kind, you know, Rush had a big impact. I mean, if you listen to rock music, Rush is just one of those legendary bands. And Power Trio, you got to love a Power Trio. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that was a big one. So we'll pay a little tribute to Neil Peart a little bit later on. So, okay, here's the deal. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have Steve and Eric join us on the phone here, and we'll fly through our list of the best films of the past decade. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back with that after this. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. By the way, Walter Jacobson's perspective is coming up in a little bit as well. And we'll tell you all about that coming up. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Sunday night into Monday morning, and that's when we do the Monday morning movie reviews. But this week we are going to talk about the best films of the decade. Last week, Steve and Eric were here, and we talked about the best movies of 2019. Now we're going to take on the decade on our favorite movies of the past 10 years. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us with your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Let's welcome Steve to the show. Steve, welcome.
Hey, hello.
And Eric, welcome.
Hello.
All right. So I got a list of 20 here. Is that mm-hmm. you guys have a list of 20?
Yes.
Okay. Of the best films of the decade, and it's a pretty strong. I'm looking at this list, and there's a lot of good movies came out over the past 10 years.
There are a few.
This is an impossible task, Nick.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing, man, to narrow it down and look back at all of them. And, I'm sure that I missed a few here, but I was just looking back at my, because I still have all my top 10 lists from the past 10 years. And I looked at them and I scoured over them and I looked at what was in the top and kind of mixed things up a little bit. But the only non-difficult choice was number one for me.
I think the entire listening audience can predict.
Please.
Yeah, you're watching it right now.
I wish I was. I guess we'll do it this way. Why don't we go through, because it'll take us 9 hours to get through the entire list if we don't kind of plow through it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we go with our bottom five from 20 to 16 first?
Okay.
All right, so I'll go 20 to 16, and then Steve, you can go 20 to 16, mm-hmm. and Eric, you go 20 to 16, and we'll chat a little bit about them. But
sure.
I'll start with number 20. Number 20 is Her Smell, which we just talked about last week, which was my favorite movie of 2019. Number 19 is Her, the Joaquin Phoenix film with Scarlett Johansson's voice. 18 is Robert Zemeckis' The Walk. 17 is Gravity. And 16 is The Babadook. So it's Her Smell, Her, The Walk, Gravity, and The Babadook. That's 20 to 16 on my list. All right. Steve, what about you?
My number 20 is Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive. Mm. Number 19 is The Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, man.
Number 18 is, speaking of Michael Shannon, The Shape of Water. Number 17 is A Ghost Story, and number 16 is Ex Machina.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I miss Cabin in the Woods. How did I miss Cabin in the Woods? I love that movie so much.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Eric, 20 to 16.
My number 20 is Sing Street. My number 19 is Before Midnight. My number 18 is Spotlight. My number 17 is The Social Network, and my number 16 is Jackie.
Oh, wow. Jackie, okay.
Yeah, love that movie.
Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's really good in that movie.
Yeah.
Did she get nominated for that?
She did.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did not win, though.
Okay. Now, speaking of nominees, that's announced in a few hours.
It certainly is.
The mm-hmm. Academy Awards. Is it weird, or does it normally, they don't announce them on Mondays, right? Didn't they usually announce them on Tuesdays?
Usually Tuesdays, yes.
So why the change?
I don't know the change, why they changed to Monday. Everything is moved up because they basically moved the ceremony up to like early February now, I think. Mm-hmm. It's like second week of February or something like
that.
Yeah,
it's like the 7th or 8th of February is the...
Yeah, I mean, they talked about doing this a few years ago where they talked about moving everything up to sort of curb the whole idea of the campaigning and all the other award shows and all that kind of stuff. They really wanted to put the focus on the Oscars. But I don't know if it just kicked in this year or what exactly that worked. I haven't paid as much attention to it as I normally do. But it is weird.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, man, back in the day, I remember when the Oscars were in April.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. They were it was like the first week in April was when the Academy Awards were. Because I remember there was the day that Reagan got shot was the day of the Oscars.
Oh, really?
And that was in April. Mm. And when Reagan got shot, it was the first time. This was 1981.
They're talking about canceling it, right?
Well, they delayed it a day.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was supposed to happen that night, and then they delayed it a day.
Wow.
Because of, you know, Reagan being shot. And that was the year that Ordinary People won, and De Niro won for Best Actor for Raging Bull. That was the year, but it was delayed one full day. But I remember that was back in the day when it would run in April. So
wow,
yeah, you'd have to wait all the way till April. So let's see. So we got our bottom five here. I said Her Smell, Her, The Walk, Gravity, and The Babadook. I can't believe I forgot Cabin in the Woods.
To me, in a lot of ways, that movie kind of challenged the way horror movies had been made up to that point.
Yeah.
And I think it actually, in a weird way, forced the younger generation of horror directors to be more creative and emphasize character a little more and make it a little less cliche. And I really do believe it had that impact, and it did it with laughs, so it wasn't necessarily being mean about it. It was just like, hey, guys, we know all the tricks. Let's make some new ones up.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I love that movie, and I remember the first time I saw it, the opening scene, I was like, "What is this?" Like, I had no idea what was happening, and I was like, "What's going on?" And as it went on, I just love to watch like the final 10 minutes of that movie,
yeah,
because it's just insane, and there's so much stuff going on, you know, with all the compartmentalized stuff. I love that movie, and I can't believe I didn't include it because I'm an idiot. All right, let's go 15 through 11 here. My number 15 is Zero Dark 30, 14 is Hereditary, 13 is Phantom Thread, 12 is Roma, and 11 is Whiplash. Steve, what are your 15 through 11?
My number 15 is Get Out. My number 14 is Snowpiercer. My number 13 is Winter's Bone. My number 12 is The Lobster. And my number, we're just going through 11, right?
Yeah.
My number 11 is Hereditary.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, The Lobster, that was a good movie. Yeah. Okay, Eric?
Okay, my number 15 is Gravity. My number 14 is Stories We Tell. Number 13 is Interstellar. Number 12 is Us. And number 11 is Dunkirk.
Ah, wow, that's a little low.
You would think.
Ah, that seems a little low on your list. I don't know why, but
I like to keep you guessing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm sure that's not the only film that's going to be on there by that director. I would guess not. So going back and looking at some of the movies from there, where was Hereditary on? Your Hereditary was already on your list, Steve?
11, yeah. I don't remember if that was my, it might have been my number one that year in 2018 overall. But I will say I took a couple, like I didn't include, I had two films from 2019 on here originally. I took them out because we talked about that so much. Those films so much last week. And I also, because I literally have like a list of 30 to pair, or maybe even more than that, like 35. And I know, I kind of looked, this time I did look at your list in advance and I said, okay, anything where I might, there are some, I'm sure some duplicates between you and me, Nick, but I tried to, if there was a tie between a couple films, I would usually, the flip of the coin for me was whether it was on your list or not.
Oh,
and so
okay.
I took some of those out too. So this isn't, I wouldn't say this is exactly my 20, but it's a good 20 though.
Okay.
So, and I feel like half of them I could just dispose of and put 20 or 10 other films in here and would still be the same. It's just as good. So
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hereditary, just, I mean, come on.
Yeah. No, I know. I know. Eric, how difficult was it to put your list together?
Well, I mean, you know, we've done this before, Nick. We did this for the past decade.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, we've done this for like 20 years now, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
One of the things that I tried to do in looking over this is that I didn't just like, you know, take all my number ones and number twos and whatnot. I went through the entire list of the decade and just went through the films that I knew that were very high on my list, but the movies that I have thought that have resonated throughout the decade and I think are going to continue. So I didn't pick a lot of films that were kind of personal to me, I left off films like, say, like 127 Hours, for example, which was very high on my list that year. But I, you know, I still managed to find room for Sing Street, which I think just happens to be like the best coming-of-age movie of the decade, and was also my number one that year. So yeah. I managed to kind of slip that one in. But yeah, it was. I mean, I look at this list, and you almost, as great as these 20 movies that are going to be on all of our lists, you almost feel bad making this list for the movies that don't make it.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. All right, you guys hang out, okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
Right, Steve and Eric are here, and we're going through the best films of the decade. And if you want to jump in with your favorite movies of the past years or so, you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. More after this on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. It'll soon be Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We are going to talk about game shows and game show fails. Neil Peart passed away over the weekend, and we'll pay a little tribute to him, drummer from Rush, and we have some predictions for 2020. So all of that and more, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Eric Childress and, Steve Procopi are with us. We are talking about the best movies of the decade. We did, 2019 last week. Now we're taking on the decade. Let's get the guys back in here. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And, Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
So we were up to, our top 10. So let's do a little reminder of everybody again. 20 to 11. Here are my choices. Number 20 is Her Smell. Number 19 is Her. 18 is The Walk. 17, Gravity. 16, The Babadook. 15, Zero Dark Thirty. 14, Hereditary. 13, Phantom Thread. 12, Roma. And 11, Whiplash. Steve, remind everybody you're 20 to 11.
My number 20 is Drive. Number 19 is The Cabin in the Woods. Number 18 is The Shape of Water. Number 17 is A Ghost Story. Number 16 is Ex Machina. Number 15 is Get Out. Number 14 is Snowpiercer. Number 13 is Winter's Bone. Number 12 is The Lobster. And number 11 is Hereditary.
Yeah. Boy, you know, and some of these that you're the titles that you just threw out there that I did not include are some really good ones. There's some really good stuff. All right, Eric, what about you?
Number 20 is Sing Street, 19 Before Midnight, 18 Spotlight, 17 The Social Network, 16 Jackie, 15 Gravity, 14 Stories We Tell, 13 Interstellar, 12 Us, and 11 Dunkirk.
Stories We Tell, boy, that was a good movie.
It was like my 21st movie. Yeah, it was definitely first runner-up.
She's become quite a filmmaker, man.
I really am lamenting the fact that we don't have more Sarah Polley works out there.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't work enough, as far as I'm concerned. She doesn't direct enough. She's also a great actress, too. But, I mean, boy, what a filmmaker she's turned out to be. I mean, just really... pretty stunning.
Well, apparently she was also one of the people originally working on the new version of Little Women.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and then eventually, I think there was a point where her and Gerwig might have been working together, if I read that right, and then eventually Gerwig took the project over.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Speaking of which, did you guys see the Inside the Actors Studio? With Laura Dern being interviewed by Greta Gerwig?
No. I didn't even know that existed.
Oh, man. I watched it over the weekend. It's so good.
Huh.
It's because Laura Dern rules.
Please.
And she always has. And I was really happy that they spent a pretty good amount of time talking about Smooth Talk. Which is a great movie. And, you know, obviously she was a teenager when she made that movie. And just the work that she does with Treat Williams in that movie, my God.
Yeah.
It's really, really, it's very special. But it's great because Greta Gerwig is interviewing her. Mm-hmm. So it's fantastic to see the two of them just talking on stage. It's really, really great. Let's see. 312 area code says the Oscars were on Mondays in March. It was March 30th, 1981 when Reagan got shot, so the Oscars were moved to Tuesday. I knew it was late in March or early in April. That was when they usually did them. 773 area code says The Dark Knight Rises and Inception are two of my favorites. Let's see. Sleeper. Sleeper movie Radius. 312 area code said. 847 area code says Black Panther, a film that should be on the best list because I enjoyed it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Solid argument.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard to argue. Yeah, it is hard to argue with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Okay, let's go from, I'll give you my number 10 to number 6, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My number 10 is La La Land. My number 9 is The Social Network. 8 is Flight. 7 is Interstellar. And 6 is Tree of Life. All right. Mm. Steve, what do you got? 10 to 6.
Number 10, in direct response to your list, because I noticed your list was a little lacking in comedies, but that's not why I made my list, but I had to think of my favorite comedy in the last 10 years, What We Do in the Shadows, number 10.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great one, Steve.
Yep.
And the TV show's almost better. I
love the show. I can't wait for the show to come back. And I don't know, I always forget the actress's name. I've never seen her in anything other than the TV show, and she's spectacularly funny.
Oh, yeah. That's my number 10. Number 9 is Inside Out, the Pixar film. Mm. Number 8 is Inside Llewyn Davis. Number 7 is Boyhood. And number 6 is, I think, Nick, you had this, Her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You know, I always have a Boyhood will always have like a real soft spot in my heart. It was the last movie that Roy Leonard reviewed on my show before he passed away. And he gave it a rave. He said it was one of his favorite movies that he had ever seen. And I remember how enthusiastic Roy was about that. That was the last movie that Roy ever reviewed on my show. So, always. Okay, Eric, what about you?
My number 10 is Parasite. My number 9 is Lincoln. My number 8 is Roma. Number 7 is Inside Out, and my number 6 is Moneyball.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty high.
Yeah, that's a movie that has really risen up the ranks for me over the years. I think that movie, aside being, I think, one of the best movies ever about baseball, and particularly inside baseball, but I think it's such a perfect encapsulation of the sort of the haves and the have-nots that we deal with on a daily basis in society. I think that movie just kind of perfectly captures that, just using baseball as the means to do it.
You know, it's interesting because I haven't. It's going to be fun to go back and look back at some of these movies because like as we're throwing these titles around, some of which I haven't seen in a long time. Like I haven't watched Moneyball in years. But I remember, I really like it. I think it's great. And it's one of these deals where I think I'm going to go back and watch a lot of these titles over and over again to remind myself of how great they are. Some of these movies that are on my list, like I haven't watched The Social Network in a while. But it's just such a great film. But other ones on the list I watched like pretty regularly. Like I watch Interstellar like monthly. That's just one of those movies that I go back to and watch over and over again. And
you're number one about every 12 hours, right?
Yeah, pretty much. All right. Okay, listen, we're gonna have to break here for Walter Jacobson's perspective here in a minute, but we'll come back and we'll remind everybody of what our thoughts are, and then we get into the top five movies of the decade. Steve, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric, hang on. Steve and Eric are here, and if you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. It's Monday morning, coming up on a Monday morning here, and my dad's going to tell a joke, because that's what he does. He calls in, tells a joke. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to join us. We've been talking about the best movies of the decade. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress are on the line. And also the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. Okay, let's get back to it. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, let's do a quick reminder, and then we'll do our top five. I'll start with 20 and go up to 6. So 20 was Her Smell, 19 Her, 18 The Walk, 17 Gravity, 16 The Babadook, 15 Zero Dark Thirty, 14 Hereditary, 13 Phantom Thread, 12 Roma, 11 Whiplash, 10 La La Land, 9 The Social Network, 8 Flight, 7 Interstellar, and 6 The Tree of Life. All right, Steve.
20. My number 20 is Drive. Number 19, The Cabin in the Woods. Number 18, The Shape of Water. Number 17, A Ghost Story. Number 16, Ex Machina. Number 15, Get Out. Number 14, Snowpiercer. Number 13, Winter's Bone. Number 12, The Lobster. Number 11, Hereditary. Number 10, What We Do in the Shadows. Number 9, Inside Out. Number 8, Inside Llewyn Davis. And number 7, Boyhood. And number 6, Her.
All right. Eric.
Number 20, Sing Street. 19, Before Midnight. 18, Spotlight. 17, The Social Network. 16, Jackie. 15, Gravity. 14, Stories We Tell. 13, Interstellar. 12, Us. 11, Dunkirk. 10, Parasite. 9, Lincoln. 8, Roma. 7, Inside Out. And 6, Moneyball.
All right, so there it is. Now we'll do the... we'll do our top five here, but I'm gonna we'll save number one. We'll do five through two. Okay, so here's my my number five is Take Shelter. My number four is Kubo and the Two Strings. My number three is Blue Valentine, and my number two is Colossal. Steve.
Number five is Roma. Number four is Beasts of the Southern Wild. Number three is The Social Network, and number two is Inception.
Okay. All right. Eric.
My number five is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. My number four is A Ghost Story. My number three is Her. And my number two is Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
All right. By the way, 218 area code says, Inside Llewyn Davis has got to be my favorite of the decade. Best dang musical the Coen brothers ever made.
All right. It's pretty great.
Also, one of the funniest things I've ever seen Adam Driver do in my life. I just rewatched that scene today. I'm like,
it is.
And you realize in the way it's edited, they keep going back to him. I'm like, it's because they realize he stole the scene the minute he opened his mouth.
It's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. Yeah. I haven't watched that one in a while. It's been a while since I've watched that movie. Okay, so we're going to unveil our number ones. I'm sure that everybody is really shocked at my number one movie of the decade. Without question, it's Mad Max Fury Road. That's number one. Without question. I don't even think Colossal came in second, but I don't even think it's on the same level as Mad Max Fury Road. That's just like a different kind of level, that movie. Okay, Steve, what's your number one?
Well, I purposefully took Mad Max out of the running for myself because I knew it would be mentioned two other times. So I thought, well, let me just make room for something else. My number one is Inherent Vice.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Really? I that movie is a magnificent puzzle box of a film that took me about three times to just figure out the story. And I remember the running narrative at the time was, oh, the story doesn't matter, it's all about the characters. But no, the story actually does matter.
Yeah.
And it's there, but you can't, it's impossible to get the first time in its totality. And so But then I'm just amazed by, like, every performance is fascinating. Josh Brolin is so funny in this.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize I had a couple of Joaquin Phoenix movies in my lineup, but just, man, I mean, I remember hosting a screening of it somewhere, and I filled the screening. It was like, 150 people or whatever. And I said, look, you're all going to get to watch this for free, but all I ask is that you then go pay and see it again, mm-hmm. because you're going to have to if you really want to appreciate it. So that was my price for the free screening, was to go pay to see it. And I think a lot of people later told me that it was a good idea to say that. I can't not have Paul Thomas Anderson on my list. And then, this is just a film, like, I probably watched this more that year than, or more in the last 10 years than just about anything else on my list. So, yeah, I love that movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I love it, too. It's, I'm surprised that
it's honestly, it's like, and I love that it's so dense, like, and it's so trippy and so funny. I think it's the funniest thing he's done since Boogie Nights, and that's probably my favorite movie of the previous whatever decade that came out. So,
Okay, all right, Eric, what is your number one?
Well, Steve, I'm going to raise you a puzzle box because my number one is indeed Christopher Nolan's Inception.
Mm-hmm.
This film, it is 2010, so this movie survived all the movies up until this past December and remains my number one film of the decade. There have been films about dreams and stuff before, Dreamscape, for example. But Christopher Nolan took this to completely new dimensions with a cast assembling a heist film that is, the heist itself is almost seems so inconsequential. It's just a matter of watching these people pull it off through this magnificent tapestry of science fiction that is also very much about the art of filmmaking itself. I mean, that's the thing that really makes this thing stand out for me, is that, all the conversations they're having about planting ideas and how you make these things stick, everything in this movie is a metaphor for the filmmaking process, and Christopher Nolan turned it into one of the most dazzling, unique, visually inventive, sci-fi action thriller films that I've ever seen. It there's no way it was being knocked off this list. Mad Max is very close. It's very close, because that movie is just magnificent in its own right. But the extra added levels, if you will, of Inception make it the number one for me.
Yeah, it's a great film. there's no question about it. That was coming at a time when I wasn't crazy about Nolan. I still don't like his Batman movies, and so when I saw Inception, it pretty much blew me away. There's all these people who complain about the final shot of the movie. The people who don't like the ending, which I don't understand, because it seems, pretty obvious to me what happens at the end of the movie.
Me too.
I mean, it doesn't seem like a shock. It doesn't seem like, where they pulled the rug out from under us. I'm pretty positive I know what that ending is and what happens at the end of that movie.
He gives you the answer, and then he goes to black.
Yeah.
It's very simple.
It's very simple. Okay. All right. Am I nuts in liking Kubo as much as I did?
Not at all.
I was surprised that was so high on your list. I mean, it's a great movie, but I did not expect that one.
Your 2 through 5 seem very unique to you. Not in a bad way. I think that those are great choices, all of them. I just was like, wow, listen to those. Seem like really. No, please. Kubo was definitely my favorite animated movie of that year, for sure. I mean, it was in my top 10, for sure, without a doubt. I love that movie.
Yeah. I know Colossal's real high on my list. I don't know what it is about. I mean, I have a real personal connection to that movie. It hits me like a ton of bricks every time I watch it. And I also think it's just a really fun movie on top of that. Blue Valentine, I saw at a time when I was, I was going through a divorce when Blue Valentine.
What an interesting decade to be bookended with Blue Valentine and Marriage Story.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, but yeah, but I mean, but there was no question that Mad Max Fury Road was going to be number one on my list. It's the go-to movie for me for the past 10 years that I've gone back and watched over and over again, or 5 years, I should say, since it came out. But yeah, so there you go. All right, those are interesting lists. You know, sometimes these change depending on mood. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You could switch out titles here and there and all that kind of stuff. And I know, you know, listening to some of the titles that you guys popped out, I'm thinking to myself, how did I not include those? But yeah, that's our list right there. So best films of the decade. And we'll look
a lot forward. Of good movies.
Yeah, lots mm-hmm. of really. It was a really strong decade. So all right, guys, thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds
all right.
good.
All right, Steve and Eric, join me every Sunday night / Monday morning for the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll get back to that next week. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. When we come back, after the break, after the news, we're going to talk about Neil Peart and some of the essential songs that you should listen to in honor of the late, great Neil Peart, Rush drummer who passed away over the weekend. So we'll talk a little bit about that and more. Our phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here. It is a Monday morning. My dad's going to be calling in. We'll be here till 4. My dad will call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. And as you just heard, that's Rush. Neil Peart passed away. He actually died on January 7th, but they didn't, you know, release the news until this weekend. He was arguably maybe the best drummer in rock. Would you, Tom, agree with that?
I would say that he was the most technically proficient.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to put it. Because it's subjective who you like more.
Yeah.
Like, I really don't have any, I don't like Keith Moon as much as other people, but that's because his style was not for me. Some
yeah.
people are much more interested in what Neil Peart was doing, and really his commitment to absolute accuracy
yeah.
was bar none. That's he has that
he would and I'm it's weird because I'm with you on the Keith Moon thing. I don't love Keith Moon as much as a lot of other people do. John Bonham, arguably maybe the best drummer in rock history, but Neil Peart was right there. The thing about it's amazing just to watch Neil Peart, you know, work. My other favorite drummer on the planet is Carter Beauford from Dave Matthews Band. He is just an insanely talented drummer, who, you know, has this insane kit and does incredible things with it, and just is smiling and blowing bubbles the whole time. That's the thing about Carter Beauford. Guy's always smiling. And he's doing these insane things with his feet and his hands and blowing bubbles at the same time. But anybody who's around, you know, in my age, if you're in your 50s, Rush was a big band back in the 70s. They were, you know, I mean, it was a band, you know, but oddly, what people might not even, you know, remember this or know this, but Neil Peart didn't join the band until the second album. He's not on the first album. And he joined, after, you know, this, after they had already, you know, established themselves, with the first record. Neil Peart, the virtuoso drummer and lyricist for Rush, died Tuesday, January 7th in Santa Monica, California at the age of 67, according to a family spokesperson. The cause was brain cancer, which Peart had been quietly battling for 3.5 years. A representative for the band confirmed the news to Rolling Stone. Peart was one of rock's greatest drummers, with a flamboyant yet precise style that paid homage to his hero, The Who's Keith Moon, while expanding the technical and imaginative possibilities of his instrument. He joined singer-bassist Geddy Lee and guitarist Alex Lifeson in Rush in 1974, and his musicianship and literate philosophical lyrics, which initially drew an Ayn Rand and science fiction, and later became more personal and emotive, helped make the trio of the classic rock era's essential bands. The drum fills on songs like Tom Sawyer were pop hooks in their own right. He was an indelible mini composition. His lengthy drum solos, carefully constructed and packed with drama, were highlights at every Rush concert. Did you ever see Rush?
Yeah, I saw them in 2010 at Milwaukee Summer Fest. It was part of their Time Machine tour, mm-hmm. where they played all of Moving Pictures in its entirety, plus like a big, I mean, it was like a 2-hour show, basically.
Yeah.
And brought my cousin, who was visiting from the UK. He had never heard of Rush before, never seen them, had zero real interest, but I really wanted to go, so he came with me, and it blew his mind.
I saw Rush a few times. Never disappointing, always amazing. And, you know, some of the highlights of those concerts were Neil Peart's solos. Just to watch this guy play was amazing. In a statement released Friday afternoon, Lee and Lifeson called Peart their friend, soul brother, and bandmate over 45 years, and said that he's been incredibly brave in his battle with an aggressive form of brain cancer. We ask that friends, fans, and media alike understandably respect the family's need for privacy and peace at this extremely painful and difficult time. Lee and Lifeson wrote, those wishing to express their condolences can choose a cancer research group or a charity of their choice to make a donation in Neil Peart's name. Rest in peace, brother. He was also the author of numerous books, beginning in 1996, The Masked Rider, Cycling in West Africa, which chronicled a 1988 bicycle tour in the Cameroon. In that memoir, he recalled impromptu hand drum performance that drew an entire village to watch. Peart never stopped believing in the possibilities of rock, a gift beyond price, he called it, in Rush's 1980 track, The Spirit of Radio, and despised what he saw as over-commercialization of the music industry and dumbed-down artists as he saw as panderers. It's about being your own, he told Rolling Stone in 2015. I set out to never betray the values that 16-year-old had, to never sell out, to never bow to the man. A compromise is what I can never accept. We got some people who are calling in. We're talking about Neil Peart, passed away, one of the greatest drummers that ever lived and member of a great band, Rush. Here's Pete on WGN. Hi, Pete.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right.
Just wanted to recall a Rush concert I saw at United Center about, I think, 7 years ago. It was in support of their last album, Clockwork Angels, and Neil was always known for doing one long drum solo, and in this particular tour, he basically broke his solo up into three different segments, and each time he did a 3-4 minute solo, he got a standing ovation, bigger and crazier than any one of like Eddie Van Halen's single guitar solos. So, I mean, I think that just speaks to the power of what that guy could do and the way he could bring down the house.
Yeah, he was, it was insane just to watch the guy play drums. You watch Neil Peart play and you get exhausted. Just watch it.
Yeah.
The precision was unbelievable. He was one of the best drummers that ever lived, and it's a real tragedy that he's gone. So
100%.
Yeah. All right, Pete. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN, and we'll come back and jump right back into this. We're talking about Neil Peart, who passed away last week. So. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are here until 4 a.m. It's Monday. It means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we're going to be talking about how Popeyes gave a Canadian woman $10,000 in free chicken because of a game show problem. Then we're going to talk about some game show fails and more. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Neil Peart passed away last week, a drummer for the rock band Rush, widely considered one of the best drummers of all time. He was only 67 years old. He was battling brain cancer, and it's a huge loss to the world of rock and roll music and a huge loss to the drumming community. That's what we're talking about now. Pert was a drummer's drummer, beloved by his peers. He won prizes in Modern Drummer's annual readers poll 38 times. He was a formative influence on countless younger players. His power, precision, and composition was incomparable, Dave Grohl said in a statement on Friday. He was called the professor for a reason. We all learned from him. Neil is the most air-drummed-to drummer of all time, said Police drummer Stuart Copeland. He said in 2015, Neil pushes that band, which has a lot of musicality and a lot of ideas crammed into their every eight bars, but he keeps the throb, which is the important thing, and he can do anything while doing all kinds of cool stuff. Rush finished their final tour in August of 2015 after releasing their last album, Clockwork Angels, in 2012. Pert was done with the road. He questioned whether he could stay physically capable of playing his demanding parts and was eager to spend more time with his wife, Carrie, and their daughter, Olivia. Let's see. Here's Harry on WGN. Hi, Harry.
Yeah, so I like Rush. I grew up with that band. I was in it. They had the songs that we had when I was graduating from high school in 1981 at JFK's High School here in Racine, and that was a band. We would go to our study halls, and I would play Rush, and everybody would be on their feet and all that because everybody thought that was a thing. And my favorite song was that, like, the Temples of Searing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all of 2112 is pretty great.
That album rocked. I mean, that was one of my best things that I like, because before that I was into the other hard rock, like Kiss.
Yeah.
And I, for Christmas, my relative... from Racine here, she's going to Chicago to become a doctor in medical school.
Okay.
And she gave me a mug with all the band members of KISS.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that sounds cool. Big fan of music, Harry. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 312-981-7200. So, Neil Peart, 12 essential songs here, Rolling Stone put out. He was... widely considered to be one of the greatest rock drummers of all time. Anthem is the first song on Rush's second LP, announced the most momentous member swaps in rock history, the band's self-titled debut, their only album with original drummer John Rutsey, featured no-frills hard rock, soulful but unspectacular, especially in a climate where Led Zeppelin were operating at peak strength. But the airtight staccato intro of Anthem, which led to a crisp, racing up-tempo groove, showed that Rush... in the Pert era, would be more or less an entirely new band, one with that would push beyond blues-derived forms and a bold new vision. The song, with a title nicked from Ayn Rand, also marked Pert's debut as the genre's quintessential thinking man's lyricist. On the day that Neil auditioned, we had five guys in, three before Neil and one after, Lee recalled. The last guy had come a long way. It was a two-hour drive, and it was a very uncomfortable situation having him audition after Neil because Neil was so effing good. There's no denying that Neil was the man. 2112, Overture, the Temples of Syrinx. I remember when 2112 came out. That album. I mean, I can't even explain to you how many times I played it over and over and over and over and over again. So when did you get into Rush, Dom? Were you a kid?
I was mainly in high school.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was. We used to have this thing, me and my buddies. We got really, really into Rush. We were very much like rock kids, I guess. Very much into classic rock. And every Tuesday was Rush Tuesday.
Why Tuesday?
We just decided. Rush Tuesday just seemed to have a ring to it.
Okay.
So every Tuesday, we would wear our Rush t-shirts and just, like, sit and listen to Rush in the hallways.
Yeah.
And we were maybe, like, 15 years old.
Yeah.
So obsessed with Rush. Thought it was the greatest band of all time.
It's one of those deals where, like, everybody has... you know, sort of a period where they go through like an obsession of one particular band. You know what I mean? And it certainly happened with me and Rush. I mean, when I was a kid and I started listening to Rush, it was one of those deals where, you know, for a while you're completely obsessed. You know, I was one of those. I'm still the kind of person that can obsess over one album and listen to it over and over and over and over again. And people, you know, when I would drive people around, or if I would drive, they, you know, my cassette deck would always have like the same, you know, the same album in it, and they'd be like, "How can you listen to this nonstop?" And I'm like, "I don't know." But it's just that I get obsessive with certain albums, and 2112 was definitely one of them. But my favorite Rush album is Moving Pictures, Red Barchetta is one of the greatest. I mean, that's one of my favorite songs of all time. Rush had, you know, I saw Rush a few times, and there was one memorable time when I was at the Rosemont, or the Allstate Arena, or whatever the hell it's called now. Back then it was the Rosemont Horizon, and it was for the Moving Pictures Tour. So it was 81. So I've told this story on the air before, but I was standing on my chair because, you know, a lot of people were, you know, we had great seats. We were like 12th row center or something like that. We had really, really great seats. And they had the, you know, the metal folding chairs all on the main floor of the Rosemont Horizon. And as, you know, concert goers were wont to do, we were standing on top of the chairs, you know, jamming. And I'm standing on top of the chair, and all of a sudden I feel something hit my leg. And I look back, and the guy behind me vomited on my leg. And I was like, I looked down, and it was like all over my leg and in my shoe and everything. And I looked down, and I'm like, what? And the guy looks up at me, because he was standing on the floor and I was standing on the chair, looks up at me, he goes, "Sorry, dude, I lost it." And I'm like, "Yeah, you did, all over my leg." So I missed like 20 minutes of the show because I had to go to the bathroom and stick my leg in a sink and wash off my shoes and stuff. And I remember it was freezing cold outside. It was February. So like I leave the concert, and you know, with ice on my feet, you know, my leg. And the guy offered to buy me a beer. And I'm like, "I'm 16. What are you talking about?" So 224 area code says Lakeside Park is my all-time favorite Rush song. All the World's a Stage is my favorite album. Xanadu is considered another classic that you should listen to. And how about The Trees? You know, and I know Neil Peart wrote the lyrics to that. It's such a goofy song. There is unrest in the forest. There is trouble with the trees. It's a jam.
Yeah, and a very thinly veiled political allegory.
Yeah. Yeah. So while most superstar rock drummers of the 70s spent their downtime destroying hotel rooms and getting blitzed out of their minds, Neil Peart liked to chill in his hotel room with a well-worn copy of Ayn Rand's 1943 novel, The Fountainhead. The book has provided a political awakening for countless libertarians over the years, and it gave Peart the lyrical inspiration and idea for The Trees. It's a story of conflict between oak and maple trees in a forest. They insist on completely equal treatment and wind up destroying each other in the process. One of the shorter songs on Hemispheres, it begins like a gentle outtake from a Peter Gabriel-era Genesis album, but builds to a soaring climax before ramping back down to a gentle passage punctuated by Neil Peart's woodblocks. In later years, the drummer made it very clear that the writing of Rand no longer spoke to him. "I was a kid," he said. "Now I call myself a bleeding heart libertarian." Spirit of the Radio. This is obviously a classic song, and as soon as it begins, you know what I mean, with the opening riff, you know you're like on another planet. The 1980s were a very cruel time for most prog bands of the 70s, but Rush managed to avoid the fate of Jethro Tull and Emerson, Lake and Palmer by releasing Permanent Waves weeks into the decade and earning a whole new audience thanks to the leadoff single "Spirit of the Radio." It became an unlikely hit. It helped move Rush into arenas. Neil Peart was listening to a lot of The Police at this time. And the reggae-inspired beats he blends into the signature Busy Attacker echoed by the influence of Stuart Copeland. Spirit of the Radio could be called the spirit of music, Peart said in 1980. That particular song was written about a radio station that is a paragon. It's called CFNY-FM, and it's in Toronto. And they're still what FM radio was 15 years ago. So I listen to it constantly when I'm home, and it represents something maybe that's precious and a stronghold of some kind. Yeah, that was a big hit, man. Big hit for those guys. All right, we'll take a quick break. We come back. If you want to jump in, we're talking about Neil Peart, passed away. And we'll get into some other stuff, too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we'll be back after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here until 4. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got a lot of stuff we're going to be talking about, game show fails and much more, predictions for 2020, things that we were actually punished for when we did younger, in our younger days. But right now we're remembering Neil Peart. If you would like to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Neil Peart, drummer for Rush, passed away. We've been talking about some of the essential songs that you should probably listen to. And, of course, Tom Sawyer. What can you say about this song? We have a little bit of Tom Sawyer. Can we crank a little bit of Tom Sawyer here, Tom? Rush's unlikely career as radio hitmakers continued in 1981 with Tom Sawyer, which charted all over the world and became the band's signature song. Peart wrote the lyrics with songwriter Pye DuBois. His original lyrics were kind of a portrait of a modern-day rebel, a free-spirited individual striding through the world, wide-eyed and purposeful. Peart said, "I added the themes of reconciling the boy and man in myself and the difference between what people are and what others perceive them to be, namely me, I guess." The mind-boggling, kit-enveloping drum fill midway through in the song ranks with the break in Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight, which was just released weeks earlier, as one of the most celebrated and air-drummed fills in the history of rock. Countless amateur drummers have attempted to recreate the part in their garages and basements, but nobody has come close to topping the original. "It's still challenging and satisfying to play," Neil Peart said of Tom Sawyer in 2012. Here we go.
Tom Sawyer, mean cry. Though his mind is not for him, don't put him down his air again.
It's amazing, you know, I remember, because I started listening to Rush in the 70s, you know, pretty early on. And when Moving Pictures came out, it was massive. I was in high school when it came out, and everybody had that record. Everybody. And that song in particular, Tom Sawyer, was, you could hear that throughout the entire, like, high school when I was growing up, when I was in high school. And when that record came out, I mean, it was massive. It made a gigantic impact. It made a gigantic impact on, at least at Luther North, where I went to school. I mean, that song was so huge when Tom Sawyer came out. But it was weird because I'd been listening to Rush for a while at that point, and to see them chart was you know, gratifying and really fun, but kind of strange at the same time, because it was one of those, you know, Tom, when you kind of maybe, you know, discover a band on your own. And then when everybody starts liking it, you get a little mad. You know what, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
It's a silly thing.
And sometimes it's with bands that, honestly, for me, like, I would feel like I was the biggest Led Zeppelin fan in my middle school. It's like, no one likes Led Zeppelin more than me.
Right.
And then people challenge you on it. and you're like, listen, I'm the biggest Led Zeppelin fan. I wasn't even born when Led Zeppelin was at their height. Well, who am I in, you know, the 2000s to be like, yeah, I'm the biggest Led Zeppelin fan of all time.
Right.
I didn't discover them. Like, they were already a massive act.
It's weird, though, because that happens. Like, and I felt that way when Rush broke. You know what I mean? Like, when everybody in my high school was suddenly listening to Rush, I'm like, hey.
That's my thing.
What are you doing? You can't listen to Rush. Yeah, because I go back to their first album, man. But no, I was everybody goes through a period where they're obsessed with one band at a, you know, at a time. And Rush was definitely, I had my Rush period. I think everybody did. Here's Vicky on WGN. Hi, Vicky.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to say the first time I saw Rush, my parents had to drop me and my brother off at the Rosemont Horizon. In 1982, I was 12 and my brother was 10.
Mm.
I've been a Rush fan ever since and have seen them over 40 times. And
wow.
Yeah, I even made the trek up to Canada a couple years ago. I saw a Lave studio and I went to Alex Lifeson's bar, the Orbit Room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a massive loss, right, Vicky? I mean, this is, you know, I mean,
it's a huge loss. I couldn't believe it the other day when I heard it. It was bad. I cried like a baby.
Yeah.
I admit it.
No,
cried like a baby.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you, Vicky. I mean, you know, like Rush was a very impactful band that touched a lot of people, especially for someone like you who travel all over the place to see him and, you know, see him over 40 times. That's amazing.
Yep. The impact they had on me has been huge. And like I said, and being the oddball, being a female back then, it was really kind of weird. You know, other my girlfriends were like, what? You like Rush?
Yeah.
We like Stones. You know, it was always kind of,
I was
like the dorky whatever.
Yeah. I know it's a cliche, but Rush is kind of a guy band. Like,
yep.
You know, they were always associated with just like guys, you know, and so to hear such a strong female fan is pretty awesome, you know.
Yep, it was cool though going to the concerts, you know, like with the boyfriends over the years and stuff. And then you have to go to the bathroom break. The best part ever, there's no line. There's no waiting line to go to the bathroom.
That's true. All right, Vicky, thanks for the call.
But, yeah.
All right, take care.
Yeah, sure. Have a good night.
See ya. Wow, there's a fan for you. Over 40 times. Man, that's pretty impressive. Why is it some people say Neil's last name differently? Now, you know, it's Peart. It's not.
It's Peart. Like spear with a P and a T on it.
Okay.
Peart.
Okay. In the video that they do with Paul Rudd and Jason Segel, they say Peart and he corrects them.
Really?
Yeah. Because they're trying to say it differently. Like, you know, because he's like Peart, Peart, Peart.
There's got to be a video of.
I've said Peart my entire, I've said Neil Peart pretty much my entire time as being a Rush fan. So if I'm mispronouncing it, I've heard it pronounced 3-4 different ways.
I know. And it's really annoying because there's even a video on RollingStone.com of Geddy Lee saying that it's like ear with a P and a T on it.
Peart.
Peart. But that video, they're just like, no, it's Peart. I don't think he ever really cared all that much.
No. I mean, I would like to get it right.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And just, I mean, obviously in his honor. You know, but I've said Peart my whole.
Yeah, Neil Peart.
I've said Neil Peart the whole time I've been a fan. And if I've been mispronouncing it, I apologize. But yeah. 847 area code says, I remember all the kids in high school wearing their T-shirts the next day in school. Everybody had Rush T-shirts. We weren't allowed to wear T-shirts, though, at my school.
Uniforms?
No, we didn't have uniforms, but we just couldn't wear shirts that had stuff written on them.
Oh, okay.
You know, but we didn't have uniforms. And that actually started the year I got there. That started, because before that, I was looking at old pictures and old yearbooks and stuff. There's people with Zeppelin shirts on with long hair. Because I started high school in 1979, so it was like right at the end of the you know, long-haired, burnout Zeppelin era, where you just wore Zeppelin t-shirts and blew weed. And that, I you know, and so they had to, they drew a line in the sand at Luther North. They were like, you can't wear these t-shirts anymore, because everybody was walking around with Sabbath shirts on and stuff, and everybody was high. And they were trying to curb a little bit of that. So the year that I got there, 1979, was you couldn't wear t-shirts with anything written on them. Unless it was a Luther North t-shirt. You could wear a Luther North shirt.
Yeah, like property of Luther North Athletics.
Exactly.
That sort of stuff.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Or like your gym shirt, which would just say Luther North and have the Wildcat logo on it. That was fine. But you couldn't wear a Rush shirt anymore. That was half my closet. Was concert shirts. I wore concert shirts all. I wore band shirts all the time in grade school. 847 area code says since 1981, when I was 14, Rush, and most importantly Neil Peart were part of my life. They were woven into my DNA. Losing Neil is like losing a part of myself. I know it's weird to think that people can get so attached, you know, to a band. But yeah, it's interesting how people get like really emotionally attached to certain artists and certain bands, you know. Here we go. 414 area code says "Time Stands Still" featuring Amy Mann is one of Rush's best pop songs. When you combine Rush and Amy Mann, that's good. Dave says, before I even got tickets for the MP tour, I had a vivid dream of hearing Tom Sawyer live outside the concert hall. 773 area code. The first time I saw Rush was at the Randhurst Ice Arena opening for Kansas. It was the 2112 tour. Opening for Kansas? Wow. Rush in Kansas. There's a double bill. All right, a couple more songs here. YYZ is the airport code for Toronto, a city with neither Y nor Z in its name, and it became the title for the gleefully off-the-wall moving pictures instrumental. The song is a mere 4.5 minutes on the record, but it nearly doubled in length on tour when Peart inserted a daredevil drum solo in the middle. Exit Stage Left is the definitive version of YYZ. So, do you have a favorite Rush album?
That's a tough one. In terms of the one that I listen to the most, it's probably Moving Pictures. But in terms of their best, I'd have to throw it to probably 2112.
Yeah,
I think that's really like their best one, but it's really hard to understate stuff like Fly By Night. How perfect of a combination those three were coming together for the first time.
Yeah,
it's just, and I don't hate the first Rush album. I think it's really good, but it's just kind of like a Led Zeppelin knockoff at times. It's just like generic 70s hard rock.
Yeah,
and then Fly By Night is just.
Yeah.
Just a cut above. I think one of their most underrated, though, is Caress of Steel, which was a huge failure.
Yeah.
And they had to do 2112 to follow it up. They just put their chips down and said, well, we're going to do this crazy thing. Since Caress of Steel didn't work, they were basically about to lose their recording deal, their contracts, everything. And so they just threw it all down on 2112, and it became a massive success. But Caress of Steel is great.
It is a terrific record.
Bastille Day.
Yeah.
Fountain of Lamneth.
Yeah.
Just really cool stuff.
Yeah, no. Caress of Steel is really a really terrific record. I started getting into Rush. I'm trying to remember. I believe I was on board for the first album. So before Neil Peart was part of the band, so I was on board. Working Man is on the first album. Am I right?
It's great. Yeah,
yeah. Working Man is that's the big sort of like heavy rotation hit off of that record.
Well, DJs used to play it so that they could go to the bathroom. It was one of those songs.
Right.
But it's still really good. It's still a really good record. It's just that they would go so many more places.
Oh, yeah,
just get so wild.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with Neil Peart. Like, when he became the central lyricist of the band, they took on a whole new persona. And that's thanks to him. Hey, can you pull up a little Subdivisions? Subdivisions, well, their follow-up was Signals after Moving Pictures was Signals. And they were pushing further into the radio-friendly 80s. The lead track Subdivisions, driven by the pulsing Lee synth riff in 7-4, showed how Pert and the band as a whole could operate comfortably in a pop format without sacrificing any nuance that made the prog that made them prog legends. Here we go. Now, I remember when Signals came out. That was kind of the one that that really put it over the top for them, because Moving Pictures was their first sort of big commercial success. But when Signals came out, it was like through the roof. It featured what is some of the most poignant lyrics that Pert has ever written: an account of suburban alienation and the adolescent pressure to conform or be cast out. That seemed to give voice to the quiet discontent of the archetypical Rush fan. Forever out of step with the cool crowd. Asked in 2017 if the song was autobiographical, Neil Peart replied, "Extremely. How we turn out as adults has a lot to do with the way others saw us in high school."
Oh, and I love that that song has, the title kind of has double meanings, where it's like, it's about subdivisions, like suburbs.
Yeah.
It's about being subdivided as people, and then also the drum beat are subdivisions, like the numbers, like the time signature. So they were just thinking on different levels, man.
Yeah. They were great. They're also, a really great live band. Like, amazing. So, all right, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back. If you guys want to jump in, we're remembering Neil Peart, who passed away. Drummer for and lyricist for Rush. 312-981-7200. We'll be back. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're remembering Neil Peart, or Peart, if you pronounce it that way. He had passed away, a member of Rush and one of the best drummers that ever lived. So that's what we're doing. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. A bunch of people on the line. We got some texts here, too. 312-981-7200. Marilyn, my son-in-law's last name is Peart. He says it like Pert, but his brother says Peart. So I guess that's just what you deal with when you have that last name. Uh, 773 area code says Rush played the gorgeous Auditorium Theater in the late 70s. I worked all the Chicago concerts as an Andy Frayne in concessions. Rush blew me away, and I'm a girl. Deanna says Rush fandom was a major plot of one episode of The Goldbergs, and the t-shirts are commonly seen in later episode. Note, I'm your second best fan named Deanna, not the Deanna who sends gifts, unless the good thoughts count. Well, thank you, Deanna. You have two Deannas. That's interesting, because it's kind of an unusual name, right? Deanna?
Yeah, I mean.
Wow. So we have two big fans of the show named Deanna. From Uncle Gary, I saw Rush in 1974. They opened for a band we were going to see called Kansas. This is another one at the Randhurst Ice Arena. Never heard of Rush before. They played songs off their new album called Fly By Night. They played an encore, and you never see an opening band play an encore. It is unusual. Here's Joe on WGN. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, what's up?
2112 got me through high school.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah.
Without a doubt. But now I can listen to La Villa Strangiato off of Hemispheres every day.
Yeah.
That, I mean, no lyrics, but unbelievable.
Yeah, no, they were great, man. A great band, and Neil Peart, man. What can you say about the guy as a drummer and a lyricist? So incredibly talented, and they were a great live band too.
When they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I still listen to that. When Dave Grohl got up there and announced, was naming all the band members, and he came to Neil, and he goes, "I only got one thing to say, Neil effing Peart."
Yeah,
and he was like, "Oh, that's awesome."
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question about it. All right, Joe, thanks,
very
man.
Cool.
Take care.
Man.
Yep. 2112, a lot of guys got through school with that album. Here's Johnny on WGNI. Johnny.
What's going on, Nick? How you doing, man?
All right.
Hey, you know, I wanted to chime in here. You know what? I just wanted to mirror your fandom and your pain for the professor's passing.
Yeah.
And you know what? You know, talking about high school and stuff like that. Rush always kind of represented, you know, the finer things. You know, it was the rock and roll for, like, all of us dorks, you know. But there was that certain something going on that was, you know, different than everything. And the heartbeat of it, you know, was Mr. Peart.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to tell you, I saw the news on Facebook, and it shocked me. And I'll tell you, I follow you on Facebook. And, you know, I saw all the goobers, you know, kind of rattling your chain. Oh, it's just the band, man.
Yeah.
Was a big deal. And you know what? Anybody with half a heart and, you know, a little bit of taste and some, you know, some hot blood running through their veins, they hold on to that music that they grew up with, you know?
Yeah.
It's a soundtrack to our lives, our puberty, our, you know, every significant moment that you have, you attach it to that one piece of music that meant something to you at that point. And, you know, a lot of memories, you know, back there in the 80s. You know, back in our day, you know, and it was, you know, and I feel you.
Yeah.
I feel you. A lot of great stuff happened back then, and Rush was way up there in the soundtrack of our lives, so to say. So,
no question about it. Know? All right, Johnny, thanks, man.
Yes, sir.
All right, take care. Yeah. Sometimes you get attached to things, man. You know? You know, it's, and I know some people don't, you know, art means something. You know, no matter what form of art it is, it means something to you. You know what I mean? You're touched by it. It's something that you're attached to. You know what I'm talking about, Tom?
Yeah, I mean,
it's important. It's important.
I mean, this is what gets us, as Johnny was saying, this is what gets us through our everyday lives.
Yeah,
you know, I understand that you keep a healthy distance at, you know, you don't want to pretend that you're Neil Peart's, the closest person to Neil Peart ever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, but a lot of people can really identify with what he felt like singing about and what he felt like writing about, and also his personal life and his personal tragedies as well.
Yeah.
Losing your wife and daughter
in
such a horrific way. A lot of people, you know, felt that pain too.
Yeah.
They had loss in their own lives, and his ability to move past that became a really important story for a lot of fans.
Yeah. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi, Nick. Hey. I used to work at a co-op record store, and Russ and Pat Travers going to play a double bill down at the RTO Orpheum Theater in Davenport, which is a nice cinema theater.
Yeah.
And my this neighborhood kid bugged me to go get tickets to see him. And so I was over to co-op, and the owner sold me these tickets. So this neighborhood kid and I went down to the theater. It turned out the owner of the record store was sitting next to us. And he got pretty exuberant. He yelled out, Travers, throw Russ off the stage. And Travers heard him, and he was dancing around. But Russ put on a fantastic show down there. They were doing Fly By Night and parts of 2112.
Yeah.
You know, there's an EP that they did in the 90s that was like a bunch of cover versions, and they did a cover of Summertime Blues.
Oh, yeah, I've heard it. Yeah.
Can you play New World, man?
Yeah, we'll see. We'll look into it. John, I gotta take a break here.
Okay, I'll
thanks,
talk
man.
To you again.
Yeah,
bye.
See you later. Yeah. No, they were good. The thing about Rush, besides, you know, obviously we love these guys and everything, but they were such a great live band. They you know, if you ever had the chance to see Rush live, they were an amazing live band. So, all right, is this Riz? Riz, How you doing?
How are you?
All right, what's up?
Am I on the air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay, Nick, I was just wondering, I remember you guys had, like, the best of live albums, and you named all Kiss, and I don't think you guys said Rush.
Rush has a lot of great live albums. They were one of the best live bands around.
Yeah, but I remember listening to that show, and at the end of it, I was like, man, did they say Rush? Yeah. Do you remember that segment that you had? It was
it wasn't our choosing, because I think I was probably looking at a list of from like Rolling Stone or something. So it's their omission, not ours. I think Rush has great. I think Exit Stage Left is fantastic. I think they were one of the best live bands of all time. I don't know. All right, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. You saw Rush where again?
Saw them at the Marcus Amphitheater up in Milwaukee.
Hmm.
Which is in like the Miller Park where they do Summerfest. It was part of Summerfest. But it was like one of those special concerts that like you have to pay extra for.
Right. Yeah,
incredible.
It's part of the Summerfest up in Milwaukee. I did the same thing where you have to pay extra, because you know Summerfest is free.
Yeah,
and a lot of the music that's played there, you could just walk up and watch. But I did the same thing for Sting. I went up to Summerfest up in Milwaukee. I love Summerfest in Milwaukee.
It's a great time.
It is fantastic. It's really a lot of fun. So, all right, well, blast some Rush, man, for you. And do some air drumming, and he probably is one of the he probably is the most air drummed drummer of all time. So we rest in peace there, Neil Peart. So all right, we'll take a break. The news is up after this.
After midnight, we don't let it all hang down. After midnight.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here until 4 a.m., and then at 4 o'clock, our friends over at Bradley Place, the WGN Early Morning News, you will hear them, and then at 5 o'clock, Bob Surratt with your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. That's later on. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about some game show fails and some game show stuff, because there's a tie-in here. So this story here about Popeyes here, Tom, where do we find this?
So this is coming to us from UPI.
Okay.
I think it's United Press International.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened on Family Feud in Canada.
So Canadian Family Feud.
Canadian Family Feud.
Right.
No Steve Harvey.
Popeyes awards $10,000 to food to a Canadian woman after viral game show gaffe. Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen provided a Canadian woman with $10,000 worth of food after she mistook a game show question about the cartoon sailor for the fast food restaurant. So she was Eve Dubois gained viral attention after excitedly answering chicken when asked to name Popeye's favorite food in an episode of Family Feud in Canada. We have the audio on this.
Real simple. There's one question, only one answer. Whoever gets it, you're playing for $10,000. That's it. Whoever guesses this wins the game. Here we go. Name Popeye's favorite food.
Chicken.
Chicken!
Spinach, Sherry.
Tell me spinach!
So she just blurted out chicken.
Well, she really thought she had it, too.
She did?
Yeah, she's like, chicken. Like,
yeah, like
Popeye's favorite food is chicken.
Yeah.
No. I don't think she connected. And they were talking about the cartoon character.
Yeah. That's pretty funny. So who's the host? Some Canadian dude?
Yeah, I've never seen him before. it's not Steve Harvey. It's it appears to be a Canadian comedian.
Well, okay. Do we really need a Canadian Family Feud? Is a do they have like a Canadian Price is Right too? I mean,
I guess so.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it's presented by Gary or is Jerry? I guess G E R R Y. Jerry D.
That's the guy's name?
Yeah.
Jerry D?
Jerry D. He wrote and starred in the sitcom Mr. D on CBC.
Oh, sure.
But Family Feud Canada is actually pretty new. It's only about a year old.
Okay.
It started on December 16th, 2019. Or sorry, not saying a year old. It's a month old.
Wow. Okay, so it's relatively new.
Yeah.
I just find it weird that they need a Canadian Family Feud. I mean, what's wrong with the Family Feud that exists?
Maybe humor's different up in Canada.
Yeah. All right.
Maybe there's a lot more jokes about moose.
Well, listen, I'm a fan of Kids in the Hall, so, you know, I understand Canadian humor. So her family watched in stunned silence as she danced before eventually realizing her error and gasping as her opponents answered spinach, the favorite cuisine of the main character from the cartoon classic. The error came during a sudden death round that cost her family the game and the chance to win $10,000 prize. On Friday, however, Popeyes announced that they decided to offer Dubois a consolation prize. Our survey says that you got that right, the company wrote. DM us to claim your $10,000 worth of Popeyes. Dubois thanked the company in a tweet with her own alongside the hashtag Chickeen, mimicking the sing-song confidence she displayed while delivering the answer. So they gave her so Popeyes gave her $10,000 worth of food? Wow. Wow. That's something.
How many chicken tenders is that?
Man. And Popeyes is good. That's good chicken. $10,000 worth of Popeyes chicken. We should all screw up and get paid that, right? So she was very, let's hear her answer it again one more time, because she was so positive that it was the correct answer. Like, what is Popeye's favorite food?
I don't even know where the name Popeyes comes from for the chicken company, but
it has nothing to do with the character.
Yeah, nothing to do with that.
That's it. Whoever guesses this wins the game. Here we go. Name Popeye's favorite food.
Chicken! Oh my god!
Show me chicken!
Spinach, Jerry.
Yeah. That's pretty funny.
She's like stunned too that she got it wrong. She was stunned.
What?
She really thought she had it correct.
Did they cut back to her family?
Yeah, and they're just
flabbergasted.
They're like, "How could you? How could you?" But they get $10,000.
They get $10,000 worth of chicken, man. So, from Popeyes,
you throw a real sweet party.
Yeah,
big chicken party.
So there have been a lot of game show problems in the past with people answering stupid questions and being not as bright as they should. So we're going to talk about some of these game show fails. And I watch a lot of game shows, as you know. One of my favorite channels is Buzzer and the Game Show Network. I'm a big game show guy. I always have been. So if you guys want to jump in here, it's 312-981-7200. Okay. You know, Tom, they've got those compilations of the stupidest Family Feud answers.
Mm-hmm. They're nuts.
They're hilarious.
They're absolutely insane.
Yeah, maybe we'll play a few of those.
I would never do a look from you and I would fall from grace and then we'll wipe the smile right from my face. Do you remember when we used to dance and incidents arose from...
Yeah, man, Asia. Oh, that album. That's high school, man. immediately I'm brought back to high school when I hear that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. And we are live in the Skyline studio. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we were just talking about this woman who made a big error on the Canadian version of Family Feud when they asked the question, what is Popeye's favorite food? And she said, chicken, when in fact it's spinach. But Popeye's, the restaurant, decided that they were going to give her $10,000 worth of chicken. So that's nice. That's a nice consolation prize for making a mistake. There have been a lot of game show fails in the past. For decades, game shows have been one of America's guiltiest pleasures. And while some people will claim it's because we enjoy seeing the contestants win big money, deep down everyone knows it's because we love watching people fail on national television in a humiliating fashion. That's not necessarily true. There's just something so satisfying or relaxing in, on our couches to see regular people on a game show or game show host crash and burn. And these botched attempts are definitely among the most cringeworthy fails in game show history. So we've got some game show fails here. And Canadian Bill just sent in a text. Canadian Bill says, Canadian Family Feud is there for one thing. It would take longer to get on the U.S. show. We don't pay taxes on winnings, TV show or lottery. Oh, okay. So we got some game show fails that we're going to talk about. Here's Kenny on WGN. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, how are you?
All right, what's up?
Oh, I'm a big fan. I've watched so many. I have so many recorded, you won't believe. And you know, it's like I watched compilations of the fails, and I just wanted to bring up maybe a few actual, like, real fails.
Uh-huh.
Like one in general is when you watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire a few times, there have been some contestants who actually get the first question wrong, and then they realize that they made the wrong decision. It was too late to say, oh, I meant this, but yeah, then the damage is already done, and they leave with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was also one particular one. I'm sure you know The Price is Right.
Yeah,
big show. We all know that.
Yeah.
There was a moment back in the 80s where you know about that whole shell game thing where you get the prize right,
yeah,
you put the chip on the shell.
Right.
There was one instance back in the mid 80s where the contestant got one of the prizes right and wants to put the chip by the shell. He opened up the shell, and it turns out that there was nothing there, and they still wanted to put the shell, put the chip on the shell. And then Bob was like getting all upset,
yeah,
and then she won enough chips to cover all the remaining shells, which means that she's going to win. Then Bob just got so,
yeah,
pissed off, but he said, "You know what? Here's the prize. I'm going to give it to you."
Yeah, I do kind of recall that. I do kind of recall that from the old prices, right? The Bob Barker days. Yeah, there's been a lot of these game show fails. If you want to jump in, it's 312. Thank you, Kenny, for the call. We appreciate it. 312-981-7200. I enjoy The Price is Right, and I think Drew Carey does a really good job. I enjoy it. I enjoy it. I like the yodeling dude who falls off the mountain. That's my favorite. Is the yodeling dude who falls off the mountain. It cracks me up every time. Every time he's yodeling, it cracks me up. I look forward to that. I always love it when the cliffhangers is featured on the show in the morning. Always loved it. All she needed was 18 points when the Sass family made it to the fast money round of Family Feud, and Tim, the family's patriarch, scored an incredible 182 points out of 200 needed to win $20,000. All signs pointed to an easy route to the grand prize. Anna walked out on stage and discovered that she only needed to provide host Steve Harvey with 18 points worth of decent answers, and was appropriately enthusiastic and optimistic. Right up to the point where the countdown started and she realized she didn't have anything clever to say. To her credit, she did echo some of Tim's excellent answers, and that was forced again with a different response. But when she told Steve a married couple must be deeply in marriage, viewers had to question whether or not she had needed them, whether or not she'd get the measly 18 points she needed, and she didn't. She didn't earn a single point, not one. You know, that's always, you know, one of my favorite Family Feud moments was, I think when Dawson was hosting it, when Richard Dawson, you know, the classic, Richard Dawson was hosting it. So the first person to do the fast money thing got 200 points. Like, she did it without any help. Like, she didn't need to, so she got all 200 points. So what they did was, when they brought the second person out, they didn't tell her, and they started asking her all these ridiculous, like, he started asking her all these ridiculously complicated questions, like, and she's like,
pass?
Yeah, because it was, I can't remember exactly, maybe there's audio on that, but it was like, someone got, the first person got 200, so they decided they were going to play a trick on the other person. And then when the second person came out, they started asking her these really needlessly complicated and impossible questions. It was really, really funny. But that, I don't know how often that's happened, where, you know, like, one person gets the whole 200. I think that's it's happened more than once, I think, on Family Feud. But it's obviously a very rare thing. But they did they messed around with this other person after the 200 had already been gotten. Here's Stuart on WGN. Hi, Stuart.
Yeah, good morning. How you doing today?
All right. What's up?
What time's your dad going to call in and tell the joke? Because I love that part.
It's always around 4:45. I'm sorry, 3:45.
I will sit in my driveway and listen.
It'll be 3:45, not 4:45.
Your producer told me I cannot quote this verbatim, so I'm going to try and paraphrase here. But there's a Newlywed Game 1, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard, and he says, "What's the strangest place your husband ever made love to you?"
No, it's made whoopee.
And she goes,
it's made whoopee. Where's the weirdest place you ever made whoopee? Or what's the strangest place you ever made whoopee? I think we all know what the punchline of that is. Stuart, thanks. That's, by the way, they did a thing with that Bob Eubanks hosted. Where they had all of these outtakes. They had all these crazy game show outtakes. And Bob Eubanks was the host of the show. And they did show that classic, because it became like a kind of an urban legend, whether or not she actually said what she said. Where's the strangest place you ever made whoopee? And then, you know, because it became like an urban legend, and they, you know, so Bob Eubanks hosted this show where they played all these crazy outtakes from game shows, and they did play it back, and she said it. I mean, it's not an urban legend. This contestant actually said it. But yeah, that's kind of a legendary one. Kind of a legendary one. You know what I'm talking about, right, Tom? So you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty legendary. How about this? Third time's a charm. Well, apparently not on Wheel of Fortune. Middle contestant Lindsay guessed the final consonant in the puzzle and incorrectly provided Pat Sajak with the answer of the pointed desert. Pat informed her that she was incorrect, and the next contestant, James, got his turn to either buy a vowel or solve the puzzle. His answer? The pointed desert. Yet again, Pat informed the contestants that that was incorrect, but told James that he still had time to provide him with an alternate answer. James asked to solve the problem, a puzzle again, and provided Pat with an ingenious possibility, the pointed desert. It's not the pointed desert, no matter how many times you say it, joked a frustrated Pat Sajak, before the next contestant instantly came up with the obvious correct answer of the painted desert. The pointed desert. Are you smarter than a fifth grader? Prove to us that the easiest questions can sometimes end up being the most surprisingly difficult, but there's just no excusing this Who Wants to Be a Millionaire contestant messing up something this simple. The question was admittedly a bit wordy, but host Meredith Vieira made sure to repeat whose initials offer a clue so he would note the syndrome's abbreviation of Achu. Eventually, a light bulb seemed to go off in his head, and he provided Meredith with the immediately answer, D, hiccup. Sure, he seemed to instantly realize his mistake and tried to change his answer to sneeze, but as he said final answer, it was too late for him to change his mind. Once you say final answer, man, that's it. You can't go back. No going back. How about this? The next one is the one that we were talking about. Any fan of hilarious game shows knows that will haunt a participating contestant and for the rest of their lives. There's one historic blunder. It goes all the way back to 1977 on the Newlywed Game. Bob Eubanks asked contestant, "Where specifically is the weirdest place that you personally have ever gotten the urge to make whoopee?" And then we know what she says. So, if you want to jump in here, 312-981-7200. We're talking about game show fails. Do they have Tom? Can you look up online and see if they have some of those Family Feud, those stupid Family Feud answers? So, we'll play some of those back. We also have some more of game show fails. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. More after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 4. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. And, yeah. So we're going to talk about some predictions for 2020. And we were talking about the coyote, which has been captured. But that also leads us to some other very weird, unusual animal, fictional or animal sightings that we're going to get to. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Right now, though, we're talking about game show fails. And by the way, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. That's coming up. So we've been talking about some game show fails. And here's another example of a time a game show design crew failed in the manner that will never be forgotten or likely forgiven by the show's producers. In this round of Catchphrase, the contestants had to solve riddles in order to unlock a hidden moving puzzle behind tiles. When the first tile was eliminated, they were treated to what looked like an animated banana enthusiastically pleasuring himself. Things got only worse as more tiles were removed, as a snake was soon revealed in the animation, making the masturbation insinuations even more justified. The hidden puzzle was eventually revealed to be a snake charmer, but you could barely hear it over the laughter from the host and contestants and studio audience. I remember that. I remember seeing that. It's really funny.
Aren't most game shows taped? Aren't all game shows taped?
Yeah.
I just wonder how, you know, if they decide to let that, they just like, yeah, this is too funny. We're just going to let it go.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yeah. Yeah.
Like the thing with the Newlywed Game. You know? That got, you know, that got on air, and they just let it go. A little risque.
Very risque. No, but I mean, you know, if you've got something that hilarious, you're going to, you know, like Richard Dawson losing it for 5 minutes after, you know, the question of what month during pregnancy does it start to show? September. Does Richard, you can't cut away from that. You can't edit that out. Because it's hilarious. Yeah, that's like the hardest I've ever seen anybody break on a game show. How about this? You'd think Who Wants to Be a Millionaire would put would-be contestants through some sort of screening or audition to ensure that they have at least a fighting chance to make it through the first elementary school level questions. But this woman proved otherwise. She was able to brilliantly deduce that Paris Hilton doesn't possess an ink sac with which to combat predators, and she guessed that cheetahs don't either, leaving her with only squids and owls as an option. Most young children would be able to instantly answer that squids have ink sacs and owls do not, but this woman seemingly had never read a book or been to a zoo. And how this woman thought she would go on to be a millionaire, we'll never know. I remember they did a sketch on, you know, because obviously when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire first came on the air, it was a sensation. Like, I mean, it was, if you weren't around then, man, I mean, it was huge when it first. It
started in 99, right?
Yeah, 1999. And it just became this monster hit as soon as it started. But I remember SNL did a sketch, you know, like right during the height of the popularity. And Daryl Hammond, of course, did Regis. And I think it was Will Ferrell was playing the I think Will Ferrell played the contestant. And he's like, welcome to the show. You know, now are you ready to play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And so Will Ferrell goes, yeah. And so they asked the first question for like a hundred, whatever the first question is, what, is $100? The first question?
Yeah, something like that. Or like $1,000.
Yeah, $1,000, something like whatever it was. No, I think it's like $100. I think it's like $100 or something. So he asked the question. It's a real simple question. Will Ferrell gets it right. And then Will Ferrell goes, okay, that's good, Regis, I'm done. Like after the first question. So he quit after the first question. No, I'm good, Regis.
That's got to be tough. Imagine getting the first one wrong, because it's always such a gimme. But it happened the time.
I saw it. You see it happen a lot. People getting that first question wrong, you're like, what? My problem would be getting on the stage, because I'm not fast, you know, like that whole quickest.
Oh, fastest finger.
Fastest finger.
Yeah.
That would be my only issue about who wants to be a millionaire was getting past that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have that anymore.
I don't think that show, is that show still
on? Yeah. Oh. I think it's still on.
My God.
Yeah. I don't know who the host is now. I think it's just some dude.
Wasn't it Meredith Vieira?
Meredith Vieira hosted it for a while, yeah. They went through a few hosts. Didn't Cedric the Entertainer host it for a little while? Or am I nuts?
Oh, my God. I think he definitely did.
I think Cedric the Entertainer hosted it for a little bit. I know Meredith Vieira did. Because I got a little crush on Meredith Vieira, actually.
Do you now?
Yeah. So the original host, obviously, is Regis.
Yeah. And they had some fill-in hosts when Vieira was working as a co-host of Today, of the Today Show. So Al Roker did it. Like sometimes Tom Bergeron, Sherry Shepherd, Tim Gunn. but
Tim Gunn?
Yeah, apparently guest hosted at one point.
Wow.
Just for fun.
Okay.
But then Cedric the Entertainer, to be followed by Terry Crews.
Oh, right.
And then Chris Harrison from The Bachelor.
Oh, okay. I don't even know what that is. Oh, wait a minute. He's the host, right?
Yeah, he's the host of The Bachelor.
Okay, yeah. I think he hosts it now.
Yeah.
I think that's the guy who hosts it now.
Well, he did it now, but they on the 8th, they actually announced that they're going to do a 20th anniversary revival with Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel's going to host the version of it.
Yeah. Kimmel will do good.
I think so.
Yeah. I like Jimmy Kimmel. All right. In this memorable episode, Talia went into Final Jeopardy with barely any hope of winning and no clue which song from the 1999 animated film about censorship had a word censored from the Oscar performance. The correct answer was Blame Canada from South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, but Talia's answer was definitely better. In a popular SNL Celebrity Jeopardy skit, Norm MacDonald as Burt Reynolds tells Will Ferrell's Alex Trebek that he wants to be called Turd Ferguson because it's a funny name. The real Trebek never made a reference to the SNL skit, but Talia forced him by writing the Ballad of Turd Ferguson as her answer. It may have lost her the $600 she earned over the course of the show, but the laughs she caused, it was well worth it. So he actually had to say Turd Ferguson, the real Alex Trebek.
Well, when given the opportunity, you might as well. You might as well.
How about this? Price is Right model Manuela Arbeles has been with the popular CBS show for 6 years without making any major mistakes, but last April she made a blunder that will forever be known as her legacy. Andrea, the contestant, had to guess the price tag of a vehicle and had three chances to do so. However, before she was able to guess the second price tag, Arbeles pulled the tag off and revealed the winning prize of the Hyundai Sonata SE. Andrea began instantly cheering that she won, and the model covered her mouth and hid her embarrassment as Drew Carey was forced to award Andrea with the $21,960 car. She did get to keep her job, but she wasn't quite involved with many car showcases since then. That's a costly error right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a $22,000 error. Fans of the now-retired Hollywood Squares game show will never forget Gilbert Gottfried's You Fool episode for good reason. In the show, celebrities are each in a tic-tac-toe square and asked questions, and the contestants have to either agree or disagree with their answers to earn them a respective X or O in their square. Both contestants needed Gilbert's square to win the game, but neither could seem to be capable of reading his poker face. When Gilbert was telling the truth, they assumed he was lying. When he was being dishonest, they believed he was telling the truth. Each time you were incorrect, the screechy comedian taunted them by yelling, "You fool!" Host Tom Bergeron had to ask Gilbert an unheard of six questions before a contestant finally fell on the right side of the 50-50 chance guessing correctly. And that's only because Tom asked Gilbert a ridiculously easy question for which two words were mashed together to make the word smog, smoke and fog. If the questions remained even on a high school level, the game would still likely be going now. I love that it was Gilbert Gottfried. You know, the most appropriate person to have to ask six back-to-back-to-back questions to. All right, let's take a quick break here. The news is coming up after this.
As I reach for a peach, slide a ride down behind a sofa in Saint-Tropez. Breaking a stick with a brick.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. And that's every weekday morning we're here from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We've been talking about some game show fails. And there have been many over the years. Do you have a favorite game show, Tom?
Favorite game show? Well, I've always had a special connection to Jeopardy because I used to watch it every day with my dad. And I think with this whole Tournament of Champions thing, like the best of all time, I honestly, it's like this is my Super Bowl right now.
Yeah, it's on primetime, right?
Yeah.
Is Ken Jennings still in it?
I think so. I haven't watched the last episode actually. I had to get it taped for me.
Okay.
But, yeah, they're still going.
Okay.
I believe they're still going. And I think that they're trying to pick who's going to replace Alex.
Really?
Yeah, I think whoever wins, they're going to maybe have step into the role and take over for Alex as, you know, God willing, he gets better and feels better.
Yeah.
But what he's dealing with is incredibly difficult, and it's a lot to handle. So I think there's a chance that might happen. Because who better to continue hosting Jeopardy than to be considered the greatest of all time, whoever the greatest player.
Well, yeah. I mean, but those are some big shoes to fill. Whoever's going to replace Alex Trebek, you know. Alex Trebek's another guy who's hosted a lot of... I mean, he's most commonly known, obviously, as the host of Jeopardy. But he hosted High Rollers. He hosted Classic Concentration. Man, I'm trying to think of some other stuff, too. And he wasn't always the host of Jeopardy. Art Fleming, if I'm not mistaken, was one of the first hosts of Jeopardy. But, yeah, I mean, obviously he's, you know, forever going to be connected to Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
But, mm-hmm. but you know, you go back and look at some of the other people that are hosting it. I guess Steve Harvey is second only to Richard Dawson in terms of like favorite Family Feud hosts, because Louis Anderson hosted Family Feud.
The guy from Home Improvement.
Ray Combs. Yeah, what's that guy's name? The bearded guy from Home Improvement?
I can't remember. I never watched Home
Improvement. Richard Karn?
Yeah.
Who else hosted Family Feud?
He had Mr. Peterman.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mr. Peterman.
John something.
John O'Hurley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't... When he was hosting that, I literally could not... Like, think of him as a regular guy. I was like, it's Mr. Peterman.
Well, you can't. I mean, you can't. That I mean, like, he's forever going to be Mr. Peterman. There's just no question about it. You know, he's got that voice, too. It's just so...
Peterman-like.
Yeah. I hope you can feel the passion. When he's watching the what the hell is the name of the movie that everybody loves, but Elaine hates. That's one best picture, and it was why am I blanking on the name of the movie?
Titanic?
No. English Patient.
Oh yeah, The English Patient.
You know, have you seen that film, The English Patient? And she's like, no, I haven't. Oh, we're going right now. Because Elaine hates The English Patient. Elaine, you don't like the movie? Well, oh, you're fired. Okay, fine. I'll meet you outside. Okay. Any lover of The Price is Right knows that contestants are known to get a bit overexcited. But few have been quite as enthusiastic as this woman who tried giving announcer George Gray a bit of oral pleasure after a big win. Okay, maybe that's not exactly what she was trying to do. She ran over to give him a hug and tripped on the carpet and fell face first into Gray's crotch. Model Chrissy Teigen tried to help the pair and gave Gray some pretend CPR to make it look like the show wasn't falling into chaos, but host Drew Carey could barely keep it together throughout the whole embarrassing ordeal and could not stop laughing. No wonder George is normally a behind-the-scenes type of announcer. He's on the show. He's like, right, he's got like a...
He's got a little booth.
He's got a thing, booth, right? He's up there, and he's on camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he says hi to, you know, Drew says hi to him every morning.
Mm-hmm.
So. He gets to say, come on down.
Yeah, and gets to say, a brand new car.
Yeah.
Nobody's done that line delivery like that ever.
Yeah.
Not like that.
Yeah. I'm always, you know, because I watch Price is Right almost every morning. You know, it's usually like right after Price is Right is usually when I hit the hay. But I love watching Price is Right. And I think Drew Carey does a great job on Price is Right. It's a very entertaining show. All the games that they play, I really like it. You know, Let's Make a Deal is on before that. With Wayne Brady.
I think he does a good job.
He does a great job. I think Wayne Brady's awesome. At everything. He's just so talented, you know. He can do anything, that guy. I just think he's extraordinarily talented. And I used to love him on Whose Line Is It Anyway? He's a great improviser. He's just great. And, you know, that episode of Dave Chappelle that episode of Dave Chappelle's show. Is Wayne Brady gonna have to choke a bitch? All right. We also have a couple more game show facts to get to here, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let's take a break. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us for Talk and Tech. Get real in the morning with Larry Potash, Robin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, and the entire WGN-TV morning news team, weekdays 4 to 10.
Honey, what are we going to do with your grandparents' old coins and jewelry?
I'm pretty sure they're worth some money.
You've been saying that for years.
Okay, how about PGS Gold and Coin? They're the best when it comes to selling family valuables.
And you know this because...
PGS. PGS. When it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Do that again.
PGS. PGS. When it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Isn't that the place Jeff sold his grandmother's jewelry when she passed?
Yep. He checked out PGSGoldAndCoin.com and found tons of positive reviews. He was blown away by how much he got. Do you? Oh, you're already on the site.
Almost. PGSGoldAndCoin.com.
PGS Gold and Coin, the upscale way of selling your coins, jewelry, diamonds, and collectibles. Family owned and operated for over 10 years. Rated A+ by the Better Business Bureau with 3 Chicagoland locations, and they make house calls. PGSGoldAndCoin.com or 888-416-2701. That's PGSGoldAndCoin.com or 888-416-2701.
PGS, PGS, when it comes to your valuables, they're the best.
Stop throwing money out your windows.
Service to a
green tea.
Hi, this is Tonya Khoury of Green Tea Windows. You could literally be throwing hundreds of dollars out into the cold with the windows you have now. Our Green Tea windows are most energy efficient. On average, you'll get 40% energy savings over traditional windows, so they can pay for themselves. They're made in the USA, and all of our windows have a lifetime warranty. And with the latest technology, our glass actually cleans itself. Dirt, dust, and water just rolls right off.
Service to a
green tea.
There are so many deals out there for windows, but green tea can beat them all. Yes, green tea can beat any window deal and save you a lot of money. Plus, 0% financing is available. Call us now for details and a free estimate. Call 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
Green tea services, service to a
green
tea. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
Stop throwing money out your windows. Call 800-5-GREEN-TEA or greenteaservices.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, and we're here until 4. And then we'll have our friends over at Bradley Place, simulcast right here on WGN from the WGN-TV Morning News. And then you've got Bob Surratt at 5. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking about some game show fails here. One more here. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Indiana University freshman Julian Batts somehow went on to win his episode of Wheel of Fortune, but he filled his episode with more fails than potentially any contestant in the last decade. First, he filled every letter of the puzzle, mythological hero Achilles, but lost when he pronounced the hero's name as Achilles.
He totally butchered it.
Then he lost a car by trying to guess world's fastest car instead of world's fastest man when the category was person. You got to be kidding me. Finally, he tried guessing on-the-spot dice spin instead of the popular and obvious phrase on-the-spot decision. In an interview with ABC, he cited nerves as the cause for his numerous blunders. Host Pat Sajak admitted that he'd never seen anyone take more a circuitous route to victory. Wow.
All right.
Deanna says, all three main GOAT contestants are still in it. Ken's won 2, James won 1, the other guy's hanging on. It's the first who wins 3 tournament. Ah. 217 area code says, Gene Rayburn commented on a contestant's lovely nipples once and meaning to say dimples. You ever see that? Have you ever seen that?
No, I've not seen that.
It's hilarious. Doesn't she have lovely nipples? Dimples? It's Match Game was my favorite, 217 area. Yeah, Match Game's my favorite show. It's my favorite game show. Is Match Game, for sure. It's classic. Yeah. The classic 70s version of Match Game. You know, they tried to revive it a bunch of times, and it never really, it just doesn't have the same magic as the original, you know, Match Game from the 70s. They're showing every night at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock on Game Show Network or Buzzer, one of the two. They show the Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour, where they tried to revive both of those shows. So John Bauman would host, you know, Bowser from Sha Na Na.
Yeah.
he would host the Hollywood Squares hour, or a half hour, and Gene Rayburn obviously would host the match game portion. And so John Bauman would play match game while Gene Rayburn hosted, and then they'd switch off, and Gene Rayburn would play Hollywood Squares while John Bauman came out. It's not good. And it's weird, too, because it's like, it's so 80s. Like, I'm looking at some of the people, some of the celebrities that they have on, and I'm like, who the hell is that? But it's on every night. And it's kind of compelling to watch because it's just bad. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you're watching this thing. You're like, I can't stop watching. It's just terrible. So we've got some things here that are they real or not? The science behind 12 unusual sightings. So, you know, we had the coyote running around in the city. And so they got him. But now there's, you know, we've always had these weird sightings of creatures and stuff. You ever notice that?
Yeah, I remember at one point early on when I started here at GN, there was the whole Mothman thing.
Oh yeah,
like it got very real for a second, and I was honestly freaked out because I find the legend of the Mothman to be very unsettling.
My my ex-wife was terrified by that movie, the Richard Gere.
Mothman Prophecies, yeah.
Terrified. It's like this. She's like, it's the scariest movie I've ever seen in my life. And it's a really scary movie. It's a good movie. But yeah, that deals with these kind of things. Imagine you're hiking in the woods when you hear a twig snap. Whirling around, you get a glimpse of something large, large and hairy. Have you just sighted Bigfoot? Is Bigfoot still getting sighted? People still going, hey, there's Bigfoot. Is that still happening?
People seeing Bigfoot?
Yeah.
I mean, people see a lot of stuff out there.
Bigfoot, man, I remember, like, in the 70s, Bigfoot was just huge. Well, I don't mean that, but I mean, like, the sightings of Bigfoot was a big thing, mm-hmm. You know? And they made movies out of it, and, you know.
I think there's been a certain ration popularity of the television shows. People who just set out looking for cryptids, you know, cryptozoology, these kind of animals that aren't supposed to exist but could exist, and people looking and trying to figure out the veracity of those claims.
Yeah,
there's a ton of shows dealing with like searching for Sasquatch and stuff.
Just because there's no such thing as Sasquatch doesn't mean that there's no science behind some of the reported sightings of beasts that never existed or animals that roam the earth but have long been extinct. Here are some hard to believe tales behind hard to believe creatures. You guys remember any of these? 312-981-7200. The Tasmanian tiger. You remember the Tasmanian tiger?
Yeah. Well, because it existed. That was one of the things, is that the Tasmanian tiger, I think, existed.
Tasmanian tiger's tale is one of woe. Once Australia's largest carnivorous marsupial, it was hunted to death after European settlers landed on the continent in the 1800s. The last Tasmanian tiger died in a zoo in Hobart, Australia in 1936. Or did it?
Ooh.
One observer... Or did it? An extremely long-shot search for living Tasmanian tigers kicked up in 2017... after two plausible-seeming reports that the animals had been seen in the wild. One observer was an employee of the Queensland Park Service, and the other was an avid outdoorsman. A few months later, a group of Tasmanian tiger enthusiasts released a video they said showed a living tiger in the wild. However, experts were skeptical that the blurry images showed it was just a dog-like marsupial that's still out there, and it hasn't been presented as proof just yet. Oh, boy. How about that? So what's the difference between a Yeti and a Bigfoot?
That's a good question. I think the Yeti is more like cold climate. Think of them as being up in like the Himalayas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Bigfoot's just hanging around, just in the woods.
Bigfoot is the big guy of cryptozoology, the study of mythical beasts. This hairy humanoid seems to pop up everywhere from the forests of Pennsylvania to Pacific Northwest to the Pacific Northwest. Alas, there is no firm proof that a towering ape man roam in the remote areas. In 2008, a pair from Georgia claimed to have the body of a Bigfoot in a chest freezer, along with DNA evidence of the species. But the DNA turned out to belong to an opossum, and the body was a crumpled up gorilla suit. DNA is a favorite tool for Bigfoot hunters, as it turns out. In 2012, a company called DNA Diagnostics claimed that a study under peer review had analyzed three Sasquatch DNA samples and found Bigfoot to be the love child of ancient Homo sapiens from an unknown primate species. When the paper finally did appear, however, it was in a brand new journal called De Novo, with only one article, the one about Bigfoot. As of 2018, De Novo had published just one other article, a piece about the same Bigfoot researcher, and early Native American DNA published in 2013. Mainstream scientists were not impressed. So here's the Yeti. So if Sasquatch is the case of hype over reality, what is Bigfoot's snowbound cousin? Oh, yeah, you're right. The Yeti is cold. Cold climate. So the Yeti is a legend in the Himalayan mountains. He is said to be 6 feet or 7 feet tall and covered in dark hair. Scientific evidence of the Yeti has popped up occasionally from claims of mysterious footprints, probably bear tracks, in the Himalaya in 2007 by TV presenter Josh Gates, to a clump of fur and a Yeti bed in Siberia found in Russia by a Russian team in 2011. These claims have led to a big pile of nothing except shameless self-promotion. In 2015, the Siberian Times reported that enterprising entrepreneurs had canned air from an Azkiaka cave where the Yeti evidence was apparently found. For $3, tourists could take home a breath of Yeti cave air. Now, the Loch Ness Monster, now you're familiar with the Loch Ness Monster pretty well.
I would say so, yes.
Because you are, you've lived in Scotland.
Yep.
How do the Scots like Loch Ness, Nessie?
Oh, I mean, it's kind of a point of national pride. Really, yeah. Really, honestly. I mean, you can sell plushes of it. You can sell all these different books about it and this, that, the next thing. I think they've pretty much definitively said that there's no real evidence to suggest that there is a giant lake monster living in Loch Ness, but it's just kind of fun. It's fun to
so they embrace it over there. Then
oh, totally,
yeah,
totally.
It's, sell the t-shirts and all that stuff. And
yeah, and people go to Loch Ness all the time. And you know, when you pay for these sorts of things, it helps preserve the natural beauty of a place like Loch Ness.
Yeah,
so people come for the monster and all that stuff, but really, it's an opportunity for people to see a natural wonder and just take it all in, mm-hmm. even if it's under the pretense of finding a large lake monster.
I love the pictures of the Loch Ness Monster. I think it's cool.
I went through a phase when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I was definitely obsessed with the idea.
Yeah, I like those conspiracy things. You know, the little like, is this creature real or, you know? And there's a ton of them too, which is what we're talking about here. Another mythical monster that has provided ample opportunities for commercialization, Nessie, is a lake creature said to live in the depths of Loch Ness in the Scottish Highlands. The murky, frigid lake is prime monster territory. It's up to 755 feet deep, providing plenty of space to hide. But Nessie sightings are more often shown to those to be rotting logs or mere imagination or hoaxes. The most famous piece of Nessie evidence was a photograph taken in 1934, supposedly showing Nessie's long neck extending from the surface of Loch Ness. But this photo turned out to be a hoax, made with a toy submarine and some wood putty. Ah, okay. Yeah. So have they, what's it, I mean, over there, How often do they have sightings? Has it slowed down at all?
I think it's slowed down a decent amount, especially after the photo that you were speaking of, probably the most famous photo of the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah,
was debunked.
Yeah,
I think it slowed things down a little bit. I think in general, like for the Nessie people, it's slowed down a little bit, and even fans of cryptozoology have kind of moved on to other different creatures, but that'll always be one of the legendary ones. It'll
sure.
always be one of the ones that people remember. You talk about these, you know, legends and mythology and stuff like that, you're gonna bring up Nessie.
Yep.
Especially for Scotland.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll come back. We've got more of these unusual sightings and mythical creatures and more, but we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN and jump back into it. 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in, talk or text.
Mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 4 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're talking about some of these unusual sightings in these mythical creatures, like the Loch Ness Monster. And, yeah. So, how about this? A real unicorn for another creature here. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. The Saola is a species that could be mistaken for a myth, but it is real. Sometimes known as the Asian unicorn, the Saola is a creature related to wild cattle that lives in remote areas of Vietnam and Laos. It is seldom seen and was only discovered in 1992. The evidence then, a single skull with a pair of long straight horns, according to the World Wildlife Fund. In 1999, a couple of Saolas were seen on camera traps, proving that they still survived in the wild. The next confirmed sighting wasn't until 2010, when villagers in Laos captured an adult male and brought it to an enclosure in their village. Sadly, the ordeal of captivity killed the Saola, but the incident did prove that the animal still survived in the region. There are no Saolas in captivity anywhere in the world, and the species is considered critically endangered. All right. 815 area code says, Bigfoot is real. Don't you recall Harry and the Hendersons? yeah, I still can't believe that became a TV show.
Can't believe it was a movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's enough. That was enough right there. Harry and the Hendersons. John Lithgow. Who was on the TV show? Was it Bruce Davidson? Am I nuts? Was Bruce Davidson the father on Harry and the Hendersons, the TV show?
Yeah, Bruce Davidson. Molly Cheek.
What year was that?
The TV series was...
the movie was like 88, something like that.
Yeah, I think 91, it looks like.
91 was the TV series?
Yeah, season one, 1991 to 1993.
It was on for two seasons.
Three.
Three seasons?
Yes. There was season one in 1991. Oh. I'm guessing spring of 91, then fall of 91 to spring of 92. And then it was done by 1993.
All right. How about a mermaid? And we've all seen Splash. Given all the weirdness that lurks in the ocean's depths, it's hard to fault early sailors for supposedly sighting half-fish, half-human mermaids. Some of these sightings persist in modern times, including a spate of sightings in the Israeli beach town of Kiryat Yam in 2009. Nothing ever came of them, despite a $1 million reward offered to the first person to snap a photo. A mermaid who was also one of sideshow entrepreneur P.T. Barnum's most famous hoaxes. In the 1840s, Barnum exhibited the Fiji mermaid, F-E-J-E-E, Fiji mermaid, which was actually the torso and the head of an ape sewn onto the body of a fish. yeah, you know, that gets me to thinking about Cabin in the Woods. We were talking about Cabin in the Woods and the merman in Cabin in the Woods. It's just that's a classic moment in that movie. Bradley Whitford. All the legends come out of that in that movie at the end. The last 15 minutes of that movie is insane. How about the vampire deer? Remember the vampire deer?
No, I this terrifies me.
It's a sight straight out of a horror movie, a deer with two long glistening fangs. Ooh. And this vampire deer is no hoax. The Kashmir musk deer is real, but vanishingly rare. It lives in the Himalayas of northern India, Kashmir, and northern Afghanistan, and is considered endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The lifestyle of these rare deer is all but unknown, according to the IUCN. Villagers occasionally spot them in scientific surveys, but nothing is known of the animal's habits or lifestyle except that the only males have fangs. Only the males have fangs. Study of the animal has been stymied by violence and unrest in Afghanistan. Researchers wrote in 2014, they did write a paper in a journal about the vampire deer. Are there pictures of the vampire deer? We do a little Google on the vampire deer? That sounds scary. A deer with two long glistening fangs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking at one?
Yeah, it's known also as a water deer.
As a water deer?
Yeah, as a water deer. A water deer. But yeah, it's just got these enormous fangs on it.
So it's just a deer with giant fangs?
Yeah.
Why is it called a water deer? Does it spend time in water?
Let's see.
Instead of being in the forest, does it hang out in the water with its fangs? Wow. Okay. Now, we all know about this one, right? The chupacabra. That's a legend. Right?
I love the chupacabra.
Do you? What is it about the chupacabra that you like the most?
That it just gets portrayed in so many different weird ways, and it's just like it just eats goats. The biggest crime it commits is that it eats goats.
It's not hard to love a mythological monster with a name like the goat sucker. The chupacabra is a legend in Central and South America, with sightings reported in the Caribbean and Texas. The creature gets its name from its alleged attack strategy. Alas, reports of El Chupacabra's existence seem to be exaggerated, as sightings usually turn out to be coyotes or dogs with mange. In 2014, a couple in Texas shared a video of a hairless creature in a cage said to be a baby chupacabra. It was just a mangy raccoon. Yeah, the chupacabra, they've written books about the chupacabra. I've had authors on.
Talking about the chupacabra.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had authors in the past talking about the chupacabra. It's actually one of our favorite legends.
Yeah.
The urban legend thing. The chupacabra.
Can you imagine thinking you had one and then you're just like, hey, honey, look, I caught a chupacabra.
Man, it's a mangy raccoon, honey. I love the way they describe it. It was a mangy raccoon. how about the goblin shark?
Oh, these are weird looking.
Really?
Yeah, this is the terrifying stuff that lives at the bottom of the ocean.
There's so much terrifying stuff in the ocean. The ocean is a terrifying place.
Nothing on actual land can ever scare me as much as the things you'll find in, like, the Mariana Trench, deepest part of the ocean.
The dense mountain forests of Southeast Asia aren't the only place where eerie unknown species lurk. For sheer biological mystery, there's no place like the oceans. There are, believe it or not, goblins down there. Goblin sharks, anyway. But you might run into a real goblin. These deep sea sharks are rarely seen because they rarely come close to the surface. They have long spear-like noses and protruding jaws bearing dozens of spindly needle-sharp teeth. That's terrifying. They're typically seen off the coast of Japan, but they have shown up as an accidental bycatch in fishermen's nets in the Gulf of Mexico. Could you imagine catching one of those things?
You're out there trying to catch like a swordfish or something.
Oh, and then that thing pops up in your net?
Eee.
Most of the sharks are about 8 feet long, though one caught in the Gulf was a whopping 18 feet in length. That's horrifying. What happens if you do like a Google image search for goblin shark? Do you get to see how scary they are?
Yeah. Oh, God. I think it's tough for people to imagine because it's just so horrific. Like the big long nose, and it's like it doesn't have lips. You know, it's almost like imagine if you just had your front top set of teeth and no lips.
Oh, that's what that face. Man, I'm looking at one right now.
It's a face that only a mother could love.
Oh, man. That is freaky. You want to see some weirdness? Google image goblin shark, everybody. And then enjoy your rest. Enjoy the rest of the night. That's scary. Have they ever been featured on Shark Week?
I believe so, yeah. There's a number of strange sharks that you could throw on there.
Yeah. I'll tell you, when Jaws came out, I became like a shark expert. My favorite were, my favorite are the hammerhead. I like the hammerhead sharks. I think they look cool. But that thing is terrifying. Goblin shark. 708 area code says, what about the jackalope? Part jackrabbit, part antelope. Yeah, I love the jackalope. Always been a fan of the jackalope. I think they're awesome. They look fantastic. So weird creatures is what we're talking about. How about this? The Jersey Devil. A famous example of local lore, the Jersey Devil is said to bear the wings of the bat, the face of a horse, and the tail of a lizard. Not a creature you'd want to meet in a dark alley. Luckily, the Jersey Devil is pure myth. The legend, according to the Pinelands Preservation Alliance in New Jersey, goes like this. Sometime in the 1700s, a thoroughly over it Mrs. Leeds cried out, let it be the devil, upon discovering that she was pregnant for the 13th time. In a careful what-you-wish-for twist, the new baby was born with wings and a piercing screech. Ever since, it's threatened New Jersey's town of livestock, so the legend goes. The New Jersey Devil is described quite differently in various settings over the years and has been the subject of one hoax. In 1909, an animal trainer glued bat wings and claws on an unfortunate kangaroo and charged visitors admission to see it. Most recently, the myth inspired an X-Files episode. And the name of a National Hockey League team. The Jersey Devil. Okay, let's take a quick break here. We got some weather and then a few more of these creatures if you want to jump in. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Clowns. All right, welcome back. Nick DiCilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. And we're talking about some very unusual creature sightings and some creepy stuff like that. And some really like goblin sharks. That's just an unpleasant thing to look at, don't you think, Tom?
Yeah, no, that's not something you want to come face to face with in an alley.
No. All right, how about True's whale? True's beaked whale is another deep sea creature that's rarely seen. But in 2017, researchers captured this elusive creature on video for the first time. The True's beaked whale can dive as deep as 10,000 feet and needs to surface for only brief periods to take a breath. Scientists estimate they spend 92% of their time underwater. Trews beaked whales are one of 22 known species of beaked whale. They got their name thanks to their pointed, almost dolphin-like snouts. You looking at one of those? A Trews whale?
Yeah, yeah. They look much like dolphins.
Oh, they do.
They look a lot like dolphins, but slightly bigger.
Well, yeah, they're a whale.
Yeah. Silly me.
Yeah. All right. Well, those are some weird creatures for you, everybody. Goblin shark. That's going to be a nightmare. We're going to have like bad dreams because of that. The goblin shark. All right. We have some predictions here for 2020. I'm Barbara Walters, and this is 2020. Here's what people said would happen by this year. So, jetpacks, disintegrator rays, nuclear energy, Mars. Decades ago, academics, futurists, and government agencies cast their predictions on what would happen by the year 2020. Would submarines reach historic depths? Who would lead nations, and which ones would be global superpowers? Would planet Earth even exist as we knew it? I shall not be surprised if on my 92nd birthday I'm able to go for a ride in an anti-gravity car, mathematician and scientist D.G. Brennan wrote in 1968. Some, like Brennan, were overly optimistic. Others were spot on. Here's what happened and what didn't happen and was just plain crazy. All right. So these are some predictions that people said would happen by 2020. Okay. Life expectancy will rise past 100. Futurist Ray Kurzweil predicted in 1999 that human life expectancy would rise to over 100 by 2019. Computerized health monitors built into watches, jewelry, and clothing, which diagnose both acute and chronic health conditions, are widely used. In addition to diagnosis, these monitors provide a range of remedial recommendations and interventions, he wrote in The Age of Spiritual Machines. While Kurzweil may have accurately predicted health-related gadgets like fitness watches, bioscarves, and EKG apps for your smartphone, he jumped the gun on life expectancy. In 2019, the average life expectancy of a global population was 72.6 years, according to the United Nations. That average was slightly higher in the U.S. at 78.6 years in 2017, according to a report in the Journal of American Medical Association. Though life expectancy in many industrialized nations continues to inch up, it's been going in the opposite direction in America. The United Nations predicts the average global life expectancy to be 77.1 years by 2050. So we thought we were going to all live to over 100.
I don't know if I could handle that.
Living to over 100?
Yeah. Seems like a long time.
Well, he did predict those little Bitfit watch things.
Yeah. No, which is, I mean, that's an immense amount of people's everyday lives now.
Mm-hmm.
Bio information.
Yeah, those are hugely popular.
Yeah. And helpful in a lot of ways.
They count your steps and they check out what your heart and your pulse is and all that stuff.
Think of how many people were not actively aware of what their resting heart rate was.
Yeah.
Which is really an important thing to know. You should know what your resting heart rate is. It means a lot for your health.
Mm. Well, they've got all these little gadgets now.
You want to get some? Maybe we'll get some nanobots or something like that.
Mm.
Would you take the nanobots and have them just tell you what your blood pressure is at any given time? You know?
No.
No.
Mm-mm. No. How many do you have one of those crazy watches?
I had a Fitbit for a little, like an early one, like one that was really just basically a pedometer and all that kind of stuff. It was nice.
Yeah.
It was helpful, especially because I think I got it when I was in early college and I went to the gym a lot more because there's more time to just do that.
Right.
Get bored. And it's really cool. It tells you a lot about yourself and your habits and how much you can change that.
Mm-hmm. If you guys want to jump in here, 312-981-7200, what are some predictions that you thought would happen by now? The whole flying car thing has always been, you know, because we did just go through, you know, we did just live through the year that Blade Runner takes place. because Blade Runner takes place in 2019, which is just weird.
We started outpacing science fiction.
Yeah, it's always strange when we reach those this certain time, you know, certain time periods where movies take place. It just seemed weird that that Blade Runner takes place in 2019 and we just lived through 2019. No replicants, no flying cars, no Rick Deckard.
I'm okay with there not being flying cars.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's bad enough driving on the road. Could you imagine what kind of a moron would be riding around in the sky? You'd have more accidents. But yeah, that was always a prediction, the flying cars. It was always like anytime anybody, you know, talked about the future, it always entailed, you know, flying vehicles. So, how about this? They also said that computers will be invisible. Kurzweil had several other prophecies for the year 2019, including invisible computers. Computers are now largely invisible. They are embedded everywhere, in walls, tables, chairs, desks, clothing, jewelry, and bodies. People routinely use three-dimensional displays built into their glasses and contact lenses. This display technology projects images directly into the human retina. Keyboards and cables will become rare, he said. And it turned out to be true. Computers are embedded everywhere these days. We have smart homes, smart tables, smart chairs, smart desks, and more. Though we may not project directly into our retinas, Google Glass comes pretty close. And per Kurzweil's prediction, scientists are developing smart contact lenses capable of monitoring the physiological information of the eye and tear fluid that will provide a real-time, non-invasive medical diagnostic. Several groups of testing are testing smart lenses that will be that will measure glucose levels in the tears of people with diabetes. How about that?
That's incredible. How useful is that?
It's amazing. So that was a pretty close prediction. Let's see. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, I was at the New York World's Fair in 1964 when I was a mere little child, and at the Bell Telephone Pavilion, which was a huge thing with a whole ride experience, they had these picture phones, and they were demonstrating. They were talking to people in California on these little picture phones, and they said, oh, by 1970, every home will have a picture phone.
Wow. That didn't quite happen, but we do have we do communicate that way, mostly via computer.
Yeah, well, they were these tacky little. It was like a 5-inch black and white screen, you know, attached to your phone, and I guess people didn't really want, you know, the idea of, you know, what if I get a call and it's early morning and don't have my makeup on, that whole thing.
Yeah.
Was like, people weren't sure they really wanted that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... The closest that they came is in 2001 Space Odyssey.
Right.
It was a picture phone.
Yeah.
Got a picture phone.
Yeah. Okay, John, thanks for the call. 1964 World's Fair predicting the picture phone. All right.
By 1970.
By 1970, everybody's going to have picture phones. We're talking about what were the predictions of the future, and we're talking about some of the stuff that has happened and will happen in 2020. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text and picture phone.
That'd be a game changer.
Yeah, good old picture phone. Yeah, they had it in Blade Runner, which took place in 2019. All right, let's take a break. The news is coming up after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 4 o'clock, and then our good buddies over at Bradley Place, the WGN-TV Morning News, will take over from 4 to 5, and Bob Surratt has your morning drive at 5. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are talking about what predictions were to happen by the time we reach the year 2020. And and some of the other predictions and what actually did come true and what we're still waiting for, including flying cars. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We've got a couple of texts have come in. 765 area code says, I thought we would have established a moon base and a colony on Mars by 2020. I think a lot of people thought that because of science fiction. Marco in South Deering says the Cubs winning the World Series and Back to the Future Part 2. Yeah, they were off by a year. Because if I'm not mistaken, Back to the Future Part 2 takes place in 2015. Or at least part of it takes place in 2015. And that's when Zemeckis and Gale said that the Cubs won the World Series. So Zemeckis and Gale were off by a year. They predicted the Cubs World Series in 2015, and then it turned out to be 2016.
Well, I even remember during that 2015 season, which was a really good season.
It was a great season.
Yeah. Until we met the Mets.
Yeah.
But the guy who played Biff,
mm-hmm.
well, I remember him being in town. I think he was on the WGN9 Morning News, and yeah. he was out there trying to push it.
He does stand-up.
Yeah.
What the hell is his name? Thomas. By the way, he is
Thomas F. Wilson.
Thomas F. Wilson. By the way, he's really underappreciated in terms of his performance in those movies. He's great, especially in the third one. He's hilarious in the third one.
Mad Dog Tannen.
Oh my God! Just the drool coming out of his mouth. And after he shoots Marty, and then he's just got he's like walking away with the gun like hanging from his finger. I don't think people appreciate Thomas F. Wilson as much as he should be appreciated as Biff and Biff's relatives. Okay, here's some more predictions. By 2020, books will be dead. Kurzweil made another prediction. Paper books and documents are rarely used or accessed. Most 20th century paper documents of interest have been scanned and are available through the wireless network, which is wrong, though the net revenue of the U.S. book publishing industry has decreased since 2014. The industry still sold 675 million print books and brought in nearly $26 million in 2018. I hope books never die. I prefer to actually have a book in my hand. I like the actual feel of a book. So I hope they never go away. You like books, right? Like actual books?
Yeah, generally. But I, as time has gone on, I've seen why moving away from physical books might be helpful in terms of space.
Yeah.
I literally had to get a new bookshelf just to handle that, you know, and just we've got a lot of books. And usually when we're done, when me and my girlfriend are done with a book, if we don't plan on reading it again, or if we don't have any sort of sentimental reason to keep it, we'll usually donate it or we'll sell it to a resale shop or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the books we buy are secondhand just to save a little money on something that, we're maybe going to read once.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd say I like the smell of a book.
Me too.
There's something about
it. I like to actually have the book in my hand. I like to read it, physically have that book there and read it. I'm old. I'm an old man. I'm just an old man trying to get some wedges. 262 area code says multiple Matt Groening predictions on The Simpsons. What are some of those?
I think he predicted the current administration.
Oh, he did, didn't he? Yeah. He did. I if you go back and watch The Simpsons, because The Simpsons have been on forever. You remember how different they looked when they were on Tracy Ullman? Did you ever see the old Simpsons?
Yeah.
Like, the voices are different. They look completely different.
Yeah, they're, like, really ugly.
Yeah.
Is it weird that I think that Tracy Ullman's not that funny? And that The Simpsons was, like, really the only good thing to come out of the Tracy Ullman show?
I don't agree with that. I think Tracy Ullman's great. I think she's really, really funny and really talented. But I can see she's a very specific, though. You know what I mean? Like, her humor is very, very specific. And if you don't jump into it, you know what I mean? I can totally understand why people wouldn't find her amusing. I just happen to think she's great. I think she's hilarious. The Simpsons making predictions.
Yeah. Like, they predicted Siegfried and Roy, the tiger attack.
What?
Don't you remember that? I can't remember if it was Siegfried or Roy. Yeah, Roy Horn got attacked by.
Yeah, no, I know that. They predicted that? The Simpsons predicted that?
Yeah. In Springfield, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Legalized Gambling, they do a Siegfried and Roy thing, and Roy gets attacked by the tiger. Gets attacked by the white
tiger. What are some of the other weird predictions that the Simpsons have made? It's like the Nostradamus of animation.
I guess this is kind of a loose one, but the horse meat thing, the horse meat scandal.
Uh-huh.
That happened because Lunch Lady Doris uses, like, assorted horse parts to make lunch.
Right.
And then the Food Safety Authority in Ireland 9 years later. So that episode from 94, 9 years later, the Food Safety Authority of Ireland found horse DNA in over one-third of beef burger samples from supermarkets and ready meals.
Oh, man.
Yeah, auto-correct. They predicted that in an episode.
The Simpsons did?
Yep.
They predicted auto-correct?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here?
So Martin had, there's an episode where Martin has like a Newton, like a little PDA. And he has a memo on his phone that says the bullies Kearney and Dolph, they have like a little PDA, and it says beat up Martin, but it gets auto corrected to eat up Martha. So they knew about that. Smartwatches, but you could say that about like Get Smart and stuff like that.
Yeah. But it's kind of amazing how often The Simpsons did, you know, predict some stuff hearing this. I mean, and again, the show's been on forever, so it's lucky. You know what I mean? At some point, it's going to get lucky.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, it's going to predict something. If you're going to be on the, you know, because it's been on since like 1989.
Yeah. In season 10, they predicted Disney buying Fox.
Did they really?
Yeah. In 1998, they show a bit where 20th Century Fox, a division of Walt Disney Company.
Wow. Okay.
And now you can literally watch that on Disney Plus. You can watch that episode.
You can see that episode on Disney Plus. All right. The Simpsons. Man, creepy. All right, how about this? Your every move will be tracked. Kurzweil predicted that privacy would be a huge political and social issue, and each individual's practically every move will be stored in a database somewhere. And that is actually true, most say. Your TV watches you, your smartphone follows you, your web browser traces your digital trail. In an era when some populations worldwide live under 24/7 high-tech surveillance, the U.S. Most U.S. adults say they do not think it is possible to go through daily life without having data collected about them and companies and by companies or the government. More than 80% say the potential risks they face because of data collection by companies outweighs the benefits. All right. Let's take a quick break here. We'll take another break, and when we come back, what else was predicted to happen by 2020? 312-981-7200. We'll get back to it. We want to hear from you. Talk or text right after this.
35, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today.
Welcome back. Making some predictions here. We were made predictions about what would happen in 2020. 312-981-7200. You guys remember any of them? And we're talking about how The Simpsons have predicted everything. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke in just a little bit. And if you want to help us out, it's 312-981-7200. So there's some of the predictions that were made that would happen by this year of 2020. The world's population will reach 8 billion. In 1994, the International Food Policy Research Institute projected the world population would increase by 2.5 billion and reach 8 billion by 2020. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and the continent of Africa would add 1.5 billion people, the Institute predicted. But close but no cigar, the world's population is 7.7 billion, according to a report in June from the United Nations. The report expects the population to grow by 2 billion in the next 30 years. Around 2027, India is projected to overtake China as the most populous country, reports say. They also predicted that China will be the world's largest economy. In 1997, an article titled The Long Boom, futurists Peter Schwartz and Peter Layden said that China would be on top. By 2020, the Chinese economy has grown to the largest in the world. Though the U.S. economy is more technologically sophisticated, its population more affluent, China and the United States are basically on par. And that actually is pretty close. In 2019, China still trailed the United States as the world's second largest economy by nominal GDP. Recent reports predict that China and India will overtake the United States by 2030. Mike from Manuka says that Nostradamus predict the World War III in 2020. Didn't Nostradamus predict that the world would end every year?
You can interpret his writings as much as you want.
Yeah.
Do you remember did you think that in 2012 the world was going to end?
No.
I did for a second.
Because of the Mayans?
Yeah, I did for a second.
What?
I think it was supposed to be December 21st, right?
It was sometime in December, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And I just remember, I didn't really sleep too good that night.
Seriously?
I did. I was just like, just on the off chance. Just on something.
Because of that John Cusack movie?
Maybe. That was basically a world-ending event in and of itself. What having to sit and watch that.
Horrendous movie. Who directed that? Was it Roland Emmerich?
Yeah.
Of course it was.
Yeah. Stuff blows up and it drowns, you know. But I kept an eye on Australia, and they were just like, on the internet, they're like, all right, we're all good.
Were you?
It's the 21st year, we're all good.
were you nervous about Y2K?
Well, no, because I was a child.
Uh-huh.
I know my dad was, because he worked in IT.
Hmm.
And he was not with us on New Year's Eve 1999. Who's at work?
They're full staff here.
Yeah.
On New Year's Eve.
Just in case.
Full staff. Yep.
I can
just
even
in
imagine.
Case something went down in the newsroom, you know, and you lost, you know.
You just lost power or something like that. I don't know if anything has ever gotten that close to people being that nervous.
Yeah, no, it was a total freak out. There's no question about it. And then nothing happened. You know, you were talking about how you're keeping an eye on Australia. Once Australia passed, it was like, all right.
We're good.
Everything was fine in Australia because that was where everybody was waiting. That's what everybody was waiting on was like, okay, what's going to happen in Australia? You know, because they were predicting like every computer was going to shut down and the planes were going to fall from the sky and all kinds of craziness was going to happen, you know, because of the Y2K. And then nothing happened. I remember I was not here because normally I would fill in on holidays and stuff. But Steve and Johnny were always on New Year's Eve, as they have been, you know, as they guest here. But they were always on New Year's Eve. But they had a full newsroom, full staff working. I think our program director was here that night. I mean, it was just like it was a full office. It was like the office was full. And nothing happened.
I'm guessing everybody was pretty ticked off.
Well,
there was a sigh of relief first.
I'm sure payroll was thrilled. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
staffing for the end of the world.
Oh, man. But, I mean, it was just so anticlimactic, too. I mean, nothing happened. I remember I had friends over. We were rehearsing a play called Curse the Starving Class at the time. And it was a Sam Shepard show. It was a Sam Shepard play. And we were rehearsing it. So I had like the cast over. And, you know, we didn't, I didn't buy any bottled water. You know what I mean? I didn't do any of that. I didn't buy canned goods or prepare for anything. I didn't do anything.
You didn't have a gallon of baked beans.
No. We had beer. You know, we were drinking on New Year's Eve, which is what you do on New Year's Eve, but we didn't have anything. There was no, you know, we didn't have any canned goods or prepared things or anything like that. I just had my friends over. We were drinking beer. And then once Australia was fine, we were like, yeah. Okay. But yeah. Boy, the hype on that was insane, though. I mean, seriously. We talked about it on the air a lot. So, anyway. I had my partner, Gary Lee Wright, I was partner with Gary Lee Wright at that time. And I also had my solo show, too. And it was something, you know, the Y2K thing was something you couldn't not talk about on the air, you know? So, and then as soon as midnight hit, it was like, okay,
there we go.
All that hype. So, all right. We will have self-driving cars. Kurzweil wrote, self-driving cars are being experimented with in the late 90s. And, on major highways feasible during the first decade of the 21st century. Dozens of companies, this is kind of true, dozens of companies, including Tesla, Google spinoff Waymo, and ride-sharing giants Uber and Lyft, are testing self-driving vehicles in select locations such as Boston, Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Columbus, Ohio. Widespread use of truly autonomous vehicles are not there yet. Experts say it will be decades before we see a car that can drive anywhere it pleases. We've talked about that with Tom and Rod Pyle, Tom Appel and Rod Pyle. Self-driving shuttle, why a Rhode Island police officer pulled it over. In April, Tesla CEO Elon Musk said the company would have fully self-driving cars ready by the end of the year and a robo-taxi version, one that could ferry passengers without anyone behind the wheel, ready for the streets next year. Tesla owners can summon their cars, which can drive themselves from parking spots to the curb where the owner is standing. And what about flying cars? Porsche and Boeing partnered to create a premium urban air mobility vehicle, and Uber plans to launch a flying taxi service in 2023. I can't imagine. It will be normal to retire at 70. In his 1994 book, The World in 2020, British commentator and editor Hamish McRae, boy, that's a name right there.
Hamish
McRae foresaw retirement ages reaching 67 to 70. The main motive for this in Europe is cost to the state. Governments feel that if retirement ages are not raised, the burden of paying pensions will be so high that working people will not be prepared to pay the tax levels necessary to fund them. And it says, no, in the U.S., the average retirement age in 2016 was 65 for men, 63 for women, according to the Center for Retirement Research. That number has stayed relatively steady for men over the past few decades, but has increased for women. For full Social Security benefits, the age is slowly climbing and depends on the year that you were born. In some European countries, set 67 as retirement age, the earliest age when citizens can start withdrawing pensions. And several plan to raise the age in the next few years, according to the Finnish Center for Pensions. For many Europeans, this is a topic of fierce debate. Okay. All right, let's take a break here. We're talking about predictions that were supposed to happen by the year 2020, and what did happen, what didn't happen, what was accurate, what wasn't. And what do you guys remember? Which ones do you want to jump in here? And we would love to talk to you at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. It's going to be a long, long time. The top down brings me round again to find. I'm up a man that thinks I am at home. I'm down, down, down. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man. I think in just a few hours, we are going to hear the name of the actor who played Elton John as part of the Oscar nominations. So the Oscar nominations will be announced, what time? I think it's 5:40 LA time. So like 7:40 here or 7:20. Something along those lines, right? Do we have an official time for the Academy Awards?
Yeah, so that is going to be at 5:18 a.m. Pacific time.
Okay.
Pacific time.
So 7:18 here.
Yes.
7:18. Okay. You can watch it on your you can the live version of it is at oscars.com. You can watch it at oscars.org, one of the two. That's where I watch it every year on, you know. But it's funny because it flies by. You know what I mean? Like, you wait and you're all excited about it, and then they just fly through the they just fly through the nominations, and it's over before you even know it. And then you just, you know, and then you look at the nominees and wait until the actual ceremony. So there it is. Oscar nominations in just a few hours. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking about things that were going to be predicted by this year. How about this? Americans will vote electronically from home. As the millennial generation comes of age, they'll be able to vote electronically from home, Schwartz and Layden predicted, possibly as soon as the presidential election of 2008. Not yet, they say. Amid fears of foreign interference in U.S. elections, lawmakers aren't about to let you vote in next year's presidential election with your iPhone. Proponents of online voting say it could improve turnout and prevent voter suppression at polling stations. Startups are developing solutions for online voting, such as the Votes mobile voting platform, which uses biometric facial recognition in at least 4 public election pilots in the U.S. Last year, West Virginia began using Votes for absentee voting for military personnel stationed overseas. In one Utah county, citizens with a disability were able to vote electronically on their smartphones in a 2019 municipal general election.
All right.
Boy, technology, huh?
I'd love to be able to just vote from home.
Yeah. That would be convenient, for sure, obviously. 815 area code says, making marijuana legal. I've wanted that since 1973 in eighth grade when our science teacher showed us anti-drug films.
I mean, did you ever think it was going to be legal?
No.
No. I didn't. I never did.
No. No, I really didn't. So, I know Tommy Chong's happy. So, but no, yeah, I never thought it would be legal. So. And it's popular. Well, how much was spent the first day?
Oh my God, something in like the millions.
Yeah. People were like, I got to get some dope. It's legal. So, yeah, and I don't remember exactly how much, but it was like millions and millions of dollars were spent in one day, the first day that they legalized pot.
You would think that they were making it illegal again the way people were buying it.
Yeah.
But
probably people who probably don't even smoke pot bought some.
Probably, just because they were like, well, now you can.
How about this? We'll have personal companions. In his 1999 book, Business at the Speed of Thought, Bill Gates predicted personal devices that can connect and sync all your devices in a smart way, whether they are at home or in an office, and allow them to exchange data. The device will check your email or notifications and present the information that you need. When you go to the store, you can tell what recipes you want to prepare, and it will generate a list of ingredients that you need to pick up. It will inform all of the devices that you use of your purchase and schedule, allowing them to automatically adjust to what you're doing, Bill Gates wrote. It says, hey, Alexa, add milk to my shopping list. Though Alexa isn't sorting through your emails, that we know of, your smart thermostat isn't tracking your purchases. Gates isn't very far off. Siri, Google Assistant, Amazon Alexa, and an array of smart tech and internet of things ready to exchange data and your other devices to respond to commands. Yeah, that's you know, Gates, you know, obviously visionary guy. There's no question. Cars will be able to go months without refueling. Schwartz and Layden predicted in 2010 hydrogen would be processed in refinery-like plants and loaded into cars that can go thousands of miles and many months before refueling. By 2020, they said almost all new cars will be hybrid vehicles, mostly using hydrogen power. What's the future of the auto industry? Hydrogen cars appear to give way to electric. And that's not quite yet. Toyota and Honda had their hydrogen-powered car market, but it's an uphill battle against competitors peddling battery-powered electric vehicles. In 2018, 2,300 hydrogen fuel cell vehicles were sold in the USA. That's less than 1% of the number of electric cars sold. In other green transportation news, last year, European railway manufacturer Alstom launched the world's first hydrogen fuel cell train. And next year, London is likely to roll out a double-decker hydrogen-powered bus. 218 area code. Now that grass is legal in Illinois, is Tom going to try it just to see what it feels like?
Yeah, I would not know what that feels like. No way, no how. I don't know what that's like.
Uh-huh.
So maybe. I don't know.
630 area code says, about Y2K, as a computer programmer then, we started 7 years ahead modifying programs in anticipation. The world didn't end, yes, but things happened. The old computers had only two-digit years because disk storage space was very costly. Long story short, anything involving calculations would not work correctly if you tried to subtract 98 from 01. We had to find places in the database to store the 19 or 20 and combine that with two other digits. Just think of the overdue bills as one example. All right. So I guess there were complications.
But nothing that resulted in, like, planes falling out of the sky.
No. I mean, that's what they were talking about, too. Like, seriously, everything was going to blow up. The planes were going to fall out of the sky. So, heart disease, depression will be the world's top diseases. In 1996, the Harvard School of Public Health and the World Health Organization predicted by 2020, the world's top two causes of the global burden of disease, a measurement of the number of healthy life years lost because of sickness, disability, and early death, would be coronary heart disease and unipolar major clinical depression. At the time, the leading causes were lower respiratory infections such as pneumonia and diarrheal diseases. In 2017, the most recent year that the data was set was published, the five leading causes in global burden of disease were disorders, stroke, lower respiratory infections, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The global surface temperature will increase. Climate predictions tend to have a longer range, but here's a snapshot of where 2020 stands. A report in 1995 by Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicted that the average global surface temperature could increase about 3.6 degrees by Fahrenheit in 2100. The report predicted that the sea level would increase by 20 inches in the same year. With 80 years to go, both predictions appear to be possible. The global average temperature has risen a tad more than 1 degree Fahrenheit since the mid-90s. And since 1992, the global sea level has risen more than 3 inches, according to the NOAA. Were the predictions we made about climate change 20 years ago accurate? And they seem to be. So that's a big concern of a lot of people, is obviously is the concern of climate change, you know, and the effect that it's having on everything. I mean,
yeah, I don't know if you saw some of the beaches.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Literally engulfing portions of my old neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
Rogers Park. It was really strange to see.
Yep. So some of these other predictions of future. No flying cars, though. We're still Still not doing the flying car thing. If you want to jump in here with what you thought would happen in 2020, 312-981-7200. Humans will set foot on Mars. We've talked about this with our good buddy Rod Pyle. A report in 1996 by the Space Studies Board of the National Research Council said NASA would launch possible human exploratory missions to the moon and Mars in the next quarter century, predicting that humans would land on Mars by 2018. Schwartz and Layden envisioned a similar scenario. In 2020, humans arrive on Mars. The four astronauts touch down and beam their images back to the 11 billion people sharing in the moment. The expedition is a joint effort, supported by virtually all nations on the planet, the culmination of a decade and a half of intense focus on a common goal. Though we haven't quite set foot on Mars, we have landed 8 unmanned spacecraft on the planet's surface, but it still has not been touched by man. Boris Johnson would lead Brexit. In 1997, British news organization The Independent forecast that in 2020, Boris Johnson would become a member of the cabinet of the United Kingdom, a decision-making body composed of the prime minister and a team handpicked members of parliament. At the time, Johnson, 32, was an outspoken editor and columnist, but had not held public office. Not shy in clashing with party lines, Boris would renegotiate EU membership, so Britain stands to Europe as Canada, not Texas stands in the USA. This is pretty close to what happened. Have you heard of Brexit? Johnson became prime minister in July. He served in the cabinet starting in 2016 as a foreign secretary under Theresa May. In December, Johnson led his Conservative Party to victory in a national election and promises to get Brexit done. So that was pretty close. So, all right. Let's take a quick break here and... if you want to jump in, we've got a few more of these predictions. Where were we back then and where are we now? 312-981-7200. Take a quick break. My dad's going to be here to tell a joke right after we take a break here, and then we'll wrap up the show. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200.
It's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah! What'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in to tell a joke because we want you to start off your work week with a laugh. Also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. Let's get my dad on here. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Ned.
How you doing?
Good.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
All right. You got a joke?
All right. I got a joke. All right. Said a couple was in a busy mall on Black Friday. The wife suddenly noticed her husband was missing. She called him on the cell phone. She said, "Where are you? We got a lot to do." He said, "Do you remember the jewelry store we went to about 10 years ago, and you fell in love with a diamond necklace I could not afford at the time? One day I would get it for you." Little tears flowed down her cheek, and she got choked up and said, "Yes, I remember." He said, "Well, I'm in the Hooters next to that."
All right.
Oh, man. All right, Dan. Thanks, man.
Nick.
Take care.
Okay.
There you go.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next week. He'll do it again next week. I'm in the Hooters next door.
That's a good one. Holy cow.
Oh, man. All right. Yeah. So that's my dad's joke right there. All right, we got a few more predictions that were made by this year, 2020. Anti-gravity belts will revolutionize warfare. Imagine a world where battles are fought a few feet above the ground as soldiers hover in midair. In 1968, mathematician and scientist D.G. Brennan predicted that anti-gravity belts would revolutionize the tactics of land warfare, writing that even if the anti-gravity mechanism didn't itself provide horizontal propulsion, relatively modest sources of thrust could easily be provided. He suspected that by 2018, humans would have anti-gravity cars and jetpacks capable of operating for 30 minutes. And no, that didn't happen. Unless you're Buzz Lightyear or Luke Skywalker. Nuclear will replace natural gas. In 1968, Stanford University professor Charles Scarlett predicted that nuclear breeder reactors would make up the majority of U.S. energy production by 2018 as natural gas faded. Energy from water power, solar radiation, the wind, tides, and earth heat will not figure large into the totals. Power from nuclear power plants should be available in large amounts at low cost, he wrote, which turned out to be wrong. In 2018, fossil fuels, petroleum, natural gas, and coal accounted for about 79% of the total U.S. primary energy production in 2018. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, about 12% was renewable energy sources and 9% was from nuclear electric power. For the electrical power sector in particular, nuclear creates 19% of energy. That's pretty cool. Americans will work a 26-hour work week. In 1968, physicist Herman Kahn and futurist Anthony J. Weiner said that by 2020, Americans would work 1,370 hours a year, or 26 hours a week, instead of 1940, or 37 hours a week. That was the average at the time. Though we work less than we did in 1968, the average American works nearly 1,800 hours, and that was 35 hours a week, and that was in 2018, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Okay. And nationalism will wane. In 1968, a political science professor at Massachusetts Institute for Technology predicted that better communication, easier translation, and greater understanding of the nature of human motivations will make it easier for people to connect across the ethnic and national lines. By the year 2018, nationalism will be a waning force in the world. And the opposite is true. Fueled by backlash against immigration, globalization, and political establishment, populist nationalism, and driving force behind Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, and the rise of right-wing politicians in France, Austria, Italy, Hungary, and Poland, among other countries, Everyone looks, in fact, to one sees nationalism at work in today's world. And that's Stephen Wall, professor of international relationships at Harvard. So some of the predictions came true. Some of them didn't.
I think it takes a lot longer for some of this technology to develop, especially.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably true. Although, I mean, you know, the technology that we have now is just it's mind-boggling. You know,
it's remarkable.
I mean, everybody's walking around with a computer, a little computer in their pocket.
We take that for granted, that we can just look up literally anything we want in seconds.
Yeah.
And it's only getting faster and more reliable and better quality.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, it's pretty amazing. And I was like, as you know, I was never really on board as a tech guy, you know, but I like my smartphone. I use it, you know, all the time.
Has it changed the way that you had conversations with people? Like, when normally you would have to argue about something, like who was this actor? Were they not in something? Or, you know, what's the airspeed velocity of a swallow? You know,
you
can literally look that up.
Okay, Python. The thing is, it's just so easy now to just look anything up. And I sometimes like to be challenged, like, you know, think of, like, instead of like looking the answer for something, actually trying to figure out the answer yourself instead of going to the phone, because it's just so convenient to do that. So sometimes I like to challenge myself and not use the phone for a couple of minutes and
so
try
you can just remember.
See if I can remember the answer. But yeah, now, but it's so convenient. You know what I mean? You can't deny the convenience of having this, you know, this handheld computer like right next to you. It's, you know, I always have it on my coffee table. It's sitting on my coffee table while I'm watching, you know, TV. And I could just do the Hey Google thing. And, and it just went on. Sorry.
Let's take a look.
No, let's not.
Let's not do that.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wake you up.
I still have a little bit of trouble with the voice assistance thing. That still is not rooted itself. Because I got like a free little Google Home because of Spotify or something like that. There was a period of time where they would give you a free one if you just signed up. If you just registered. Even if you were already a customer, you get a free Google Home. So I've got the little Google Home Mini in my kitchen so that when I'm cooking, I can listen to WGN, listen to whatever.
Yeah.
And I still have trouble talking to it. I feel weird. I feel like I'm just talking to thin air.
It is weird. There's no question about it. But it's ridiculous how quickly you can get information. Just say it, and it pops up. You know, any answer to any question, if you just throw it at your phone, if you just want to, and you don't want to pick up your phone, you know, just say it and it'll pop out.
It does make it remarkably easy to get the weather because you just ask it.
Yeah.
I just turn to this weird little speaker that's plugged into my kitchen and say, hey, what's the weather today?
Yeah.
And then I can, that makes,
you can know, plan decisions. Accordingly.
Yeah. I make decisions for literally the rest of the day around that.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't quite come as far as some people had predicted, obviously, in those predictions that we just went through about what would happen in 2020 or how far along we would be. But we've come really far. You know, I mean, there's just some amazing technology that's at our fingertips now. And what's really strange is that we can't imagine living without it now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 54, so I remember a time when, you know, phones had cords and, we were talking about old technology. I remember those days and I can't imagine not having this phone now or not having the technology that's available at our fingertips now. Whereas so many years have gone by where we never had this kind of technology. Now you just take it for granted. So, all right. Okay, listen, tomorrow, 2 for Tuesday, and we'll be back. And the authors of The Suspect, An Olympic Bombing, the FBI, the Media, Richard Jewell, The Man Caught in the Middle. And we're going to talk music with Jim Ryan as we visit with him. So that's coming up on the show tomorrow, so make sure you stick around for that. And then we're going to take a break, and then the morning news team over at Channel 9 will take over.